good thing.
Okay.
Christmas. Disclaimer. Christmas. The views and opinions are here expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com.
Time for toys.
Enjoy the show.
And time for cheer. We've been.
Hey everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Birchie. Justin's here.
Hey everyone.
And it is time once again, we're at the end of the year, for a holiday special featuring a Yankee swap. So I guess to start, how was your year?
Busy.
Yeah. Well,
I good. Honestly, good busy, like, right? It went by so fast because I was making so many discs.
Yeah. Well, that's the good kind of busy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good kind of busy, and it was a good year. I can't really complain. I came out of it better than I started. So,
well, there you go.
Yeah. How about yours?
Very eventful.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the year, I was not engaged.
Right. There's that.
My beloved bunny passed away, but now I have a wonderful cat and a rabbit and another rabbit. And so that's different. A lot of changes. Yeah, it was a big year for me in good and bad ways, mostly good.
A lot of I don't want to say tumult, but it was like a lot of huge things happened this year. It was really kind of chaos for everyone.
Yeah, I think most people are ready for it to be over because most of it was just really trying. Like, yeah. Just really trying. It's funny, like, August was, like, the worst month, ever. And then the fallout from August is still happening now. And it, you know, ignites people again and sort of reminds you, like, how shitty late summer was.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know. It's 2014 can be done already.
Yeah, I'm done with it.
I'm exhausted, so. As usual, we do our yearly swap, and, that's where we give each other three films and three anime to watch.
We've not seen in many, many, many years.
Yeah, it has to be either a revisit of something you really don't remember or something you've never seen, preferably something you've never seen. That would give us something to talk about. I think we're past the stage where we're giving each other things we think the other person would really like. And yeah. Now it's just, I mean, if they exist, we will make sure.
Right. I gave you things I thought you would like for the most part.
Okay. Well, I didn't give you stuff I thought you would really hate. But that's not necessarily the goal, is what I'm saying. Right. Like, it's to drive conversation and maybe get you to watch something that's a little outside your zone, which is what you always give me.
Yeah. No, and what you always give me, frankly.
Yeah.
These are movies that I never would have probably watched of my own accord.
Yeah, and some maybe you wish you hadn't. Okay, so we'll get to that, but we're going to start with the anime stuff. And as usual, and this has sort of turned into a thing that I'm just going to keep doing, because you don't really watch new anime.
So, unless I'm working on it.
Yeah, unless you're working on it. So I can just give you new things. It's great for me.
It's like, what are you going to do, find an obscure OVA I haven't seen?
Yeah, no, that's your job. why don't we start with that? So I gave you Terror and Resonance.
Yep, you gave me Terror and Resonance.
And I am dying to know what you thought of this thing. Because, and I should specify, I didn't like Terror and Resonance. I didn't think it was very good. I thought it was actually kind of a big misfire. But it gave me a lot to think about. It gave me a lot to talk about. And that's why I gave it to you. So what did you think of this thing?
I pretty much shared your sentiments exactly. It's not very good, and it reveals its hand at not being very good very, very early on. Early episodes, I was groaning by episode two.
Really? Okay. Because I was still kind of like, well, it's Watanabe. I trust him. And I was still like, okay, well, I'm going to wait and see where this is going. And I thought, this is going to be a bad show to watch week to week. I'm just going to wait till it all comes out and watch it all in one big chunk, which I did.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with it. But basically, the premise is that two high school boys, high school age boys, are more or less being giant terrorists, but somehow are such geniuses at being terrorists that they're blowing shit up without actually causing any harm to human life.
Yeah, or at least they never even tell you about, like, people being taken to the hospital. It's never, like,
injuries. They mention injuries.
They do? Okay.
Yeah, later in the show they do mention, like, it, as they get progressively less lucky.
Right.
They do start causing some injuries, but they're what they do is they post these, you know, ransom riddles wearing masks on YouTube, and you know, the police get involved, and there's this, you know, old crusty but benign guy who was sectioned off a while ago because he got too deep in some political quagmire. You know, it's funny because the way that this has been posed and discussed online, it's, I was expecting it to at least have some ideas.
Yeah.
It has no ideas. The very premise and the characterizations of every single one of the characters from the two terrorists who go by 9 and 12 as their names, the kind of depressed schoolgirl hanger-on who is good at absolutely nothing and is there strictly to be moe.
She's a prop. Like, that character is a prop.
Yeah. She's a piece of wood. Yeah. There's nothing there. But frankly, nobody else is all that much more fleshed out or interesting.
Nope.
Nobody. And, you know, every single one of these, not only are they an archetype, but the very premise of their existence is a cliche.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Okay. So the terrorists, they were part of like this nebulous plot of, you know, government conspiracy about, you know, research on kids, you know, evil medical experiments. Yeah, didn't see that in the '80s.
Yeah, well, the thing is, what the show ultimately is trying to say is the same basic thing that Penguin Drum was trying to say. Penguin Drum did it better, I think, like a lot better. But it's the same child broiler thing where we put our kids through this horrible stuff and it's not preparing them for the real world, and it's anti right wing, you know. To an extreme, and that, you know, the child experiments on children thing is sort of a means to an end. Like he's getting to a message about youth today in Japan. You know, I don't know if that's, you know, I don't know. That premise has been done with a different message in the past, but it is similar to Penguin Drum in terms of that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just don't find anything even remotely interesting about someone saying, gee, we're really hard on our kids, and you know they're not living happy lives as a result of our societal pressure. I mean, I don't know how you even glance at Japanese society and not come to that conclusion.
Well, okay, so at one point late in the show, after all that, like, how does a show with only 11 episodes and a relatively complicated story have that much stuff that doesn't matter in it? Like that entire shit with Five. Like, the whole thing with Five, who is the other, you know, girl character, who's the other special tortured child with magic powers, that didn't need to be in there.
No. She was, I don't know what that was. That was, the whole thing with the FBI, I mean, it hints at various things that, you know, might be a little bit controversial, but it does nothing with them. I mean, you could have been less controversial and gone for less controversial, you know, hot button things that make people go, well, I have a strong opinion about this, and actually say something.
Right.
And, you know, it actually be, you know, have value as an artistic work. But instead, this just is a very sloppy, and, you know, the puzzles and riddles that it puts together. I think I texted you when I was a few episodes in, and I'm like, hey, I had no idea Christopher Nolan made anime.
Yeah, it's pretty. Yeah, it's pretty standard stuff.
It's bog standard. You know, I'm just going to, you know, have a convoluted riddle because I have this, you know, obscure reference book that I'm flipping through.
Well,
and I'm going to flip through it and randomly point at something, and I'm going to make a reference to that.
Well, not only that, but, like, all those riddles could be solved by a very quick Google search.
Yeah.
You know, they're not, like, particularly thought through or anything. They show the detectives, like, poring over them, like, oh, what does he mean by this? It's like, type it into Google.
My favorite detective is the guy that serves directly under the main detective dude,
yeah.
Shibazaki.
Mm-hmm.
And he has good hair. That's how I told him apart from everyone else. He has good hair. And does nothing other than shout the most infantile thing that would possibly come to your head.
Yeah.
How this guy has a job, I have no fucking clue.
Right. That's true. But the point of the show, the theme of the show, is stated outright, like in the second to last episode, or third to last episode, when Detective what's his face?
Shibazaki.
Tracks down the guy sort of responsible for these child experiments, and he basically states what I believe Watanabe thinks is the standard right wing approach, which is, you know, we're raising our kids to be pussies. We're a nation of pussies. We can't wage war. We're living under the yoke of the U.S. And, you know, these things that we agreed to during Reconstruction, they're crippling us as a nation. We have to go back to being a military power. And obviously Watanabe disagrees with that. As you know, that's a popular uprising in Japan right now, political uprising. So he just outright states that. And then the rest of the episode, the rest of the show is kind of after that is outright stated. I feel like the rest of the show kind of, I don't know, it's very limp. Up until that point, I was like, where is this going? I want to know what he's going to say with this show. And in the end, ultimately, it's you have to scream really loud if you want anyone to take notice of you. Which, okay, yes, that is what terrorism is.
So fucking frustrating.
And the stuff with the nuke, like...
Yeah, what the...
And somehow they explode a nuke over Tokyo.
And there are no ill effects to anyone.
No, everyone's fine.
Not even any black rain. It's all cool.
Yeah, you know, and it's an EMP signal that shuts everything down. And there's no... You don't see, like, oh, everyone in this hospital died.
It's like, oh, everyone gets cancer a year later.
Yeah, it's just, it's such
that a... That was a table flip moment for me.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, I was just like, I cannot believe you actually did that. This is retarded.
Well, okay, so the speculation, at least, I'm not sure if this is straight up speculation or if he just said this, but the person who wrote a chunk of the show is Watanabe, who's not a strong writer. He's a great director, but not a strong writer. He really wanted to say this with the show, and his name is not on it as the writer. In fact, the writer is a pseudonym, the name of the writer. And it's clear he was afraid of the right wing in Japan, which a lot of people are, right?
Yeah, that the right wing that's, you know, part of, you know, Prime Minister Abe's whole political power thing. I mean, that shit is getting really, really scary over there.
Yeah.
That they're looking more, I mean, that government's looking more and more like Russia every day.
Yeah, it's getting pretty scary, and I think creatively, like a lot of people in the anime industry, are terrified of it, even Hayao Miyazaki, because if we both saw the documentary Kingdom of Dreams and Madness, which you can get on Amazon right now, and I highly recommend it.
Yes, where absolutely.
Miyazaki changes the ending of The Wind Rises because he is terrified of the right-wing response, and they get pressured by, who is it, MTV?
Yeah.
To change it because they're like, look, politically, this is a landmine right now, and you don't want these people coming after you. So he changes the ending. I'm kind of convinced that part of the reason that documentary was made, or at least released, was to show people here's what he really wanted to do, but because of political forces in Japan, he's not expressing himself in the way he wants to. And that's a scary thing. And I think people like us who are paying attention to the art that comes out of that country have kind of a responsibility to note it when it happens.
Sure, absolutely. And had he done anything else particularly well, I might be a little more sympathetic about it.
Yeah, it's just that the show is just so fucking limp. I think personally, and a lot of people disagree with me on this, and I understand their disagreement, but I still think that, so Penguin Drum touched on these same themes, but Penguin Drum specifically referenced to acts of terrorism that happened in Japan. So the Aum Shinrikyo attacks. This is using imagery related to terrorist attacks in America and the UK, specifically America, because in the second episode, there are, you know...
Like that's very obviously 9/11 reference material.
Yeah, it's very obviously at a point it looks like they traced over images of 9/11 rubble. I mean, it's the same framework and everything.
I don't want to go so far as to say I found that offensive, but...
I didn't find it offensive, but if you're going to use that imagery... It needs, I feel like you kind of have to be a little bit responsible with it and hopefully be saying something at least interesting or challenging or anything other than just for what feels like shock effect. And not only that, it's this limp dick crap where they're blowing up buildings and airliners and police stations and no one ever gets hurt. And that's fucking bullshit. Like, that is fucking bullshit. That is ballsless. They wanted you to not hate the lead characters. But if the show had any balls, you would hate those lead characters. And the whole thing would be, this is a horrible system that creates terrible people. Instead of, this is a horrible system that creates these lovable weirdos who are blowing things up to get attention and be noticed for their plight. But, but they don't hurt anyone. Like, what the fuck?
I have a feeling like they had to... Somewhere along the line, and maybe this is the fault of the production committee system, but they had to make this so pandery, you know, and resort to so many standard boring otaku tropes. You know, the girl is moe, the boys are slashable, and, you know, kind of cute high school students that kind of correspond to, you know, Fujoshi type, you know, types that are, you know, desirable. What's the most galling about this whole thing to me is that, you know, Watanabe, where he is absolutely one of the best people working in his field, is that he is amazing at creating little moments between his characters, little moments of connection that make them real.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's why Baby Blue is such a triumph, is that that's him doing that, and it's him at his best. Cowboy Bebop is full of those moments that we love Cowboy Bebop because of its interplay between its characters in the quiet moments.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, although I think slightly to a lesser degree with Samurai Champloo.
Yeah,
this has none of it.
Yeah.
Nothing. There is like that whole, there's this whole kind of love connection between Moe Girl and 12. It lands completely with a thud, completely unearned, completely false. There is absolutely we get no understanding of any connection there. It's just there.
Yeah, it's all in service of the show's message. Everything that happens is in service of what the show is trying to say politically. And that's fine. If the political message is unique, interesting, challenging, anything, but it's not at all. It's something we've heard a million times at this point. And while the political climate in Japan makes the production of that show brave, that doesn't mean that as an experience watching it, it seems to have any particular value, I guess.
Yeah. Anyway, if you couldn't tell, I was extremely frustrated by this show, and it was something I really had to, like, by the end of it, I was having to multitask because just sitting there and watching it was getting too frustrating and I couldn't deal.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, I thought it's so short. It's like 11 episodes long. The stuff you gave me collectively is actually longer than the runtime of Terror in Resonance.
Really? Just the anime?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Time of Eve is 2 hours.
Yeah. Arslan's 1 hour, and so's Humanoid's not even that.
That's 4 hours. Terror in Resonance is 11 episodes. That's shorter than 3 hours.
Really?
Yeah. If you take the openings and endings off, yeah.
It felt like an eternity.
Yeah, well, because the show's really dragged out. I think it would have worked better if first it had balls on it and they let you hate the main characters.
Right.
And was a film instead of a movie, instead of a TV series. I think if it was 2 hours long and they tried to condense the story, take out all that stuff with 5, condense it into a film, sure, okay, fine.
I think it would have been a better anime had it had a writer.
Yeah, that's true. No, you're right. But, you know, this was a big, bold experiment, by one of the most popular and revered directors working in anime today. And it just, I felt it was just a total face fault. And, well, you agree.
Look, you know, I'm all for any sort of artistic work in that country that goes up against the man, because the man is literally arresting journalists who dare peek into governmental affairs at this point.
Yeah.
So that needs to happen. And it's very frustrating watching Japan sometimes, because that country sometimes feels utterly ballless.
Mm.
You know, with certain people accepted, but as a whole, like, it's just like, will nobody stand up to the assholes in this country? And I just, you know, if you're going to stand up to someone, I think you need to have your feet firmly planted. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of a bunch of effort for nothing, and that's what this ultimately is.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, I'm glad. I'm glad you sat through it and experienced it. And I think just as a work, it is significant this year. Like, if you're going to talk about, you know, what was important that came out, I think that show, you can't deny that. Like, you need to have at least taken a look at it and see what it is, because it's like, wait, the guy who directed Cowboy Bebop made a show about terrorism.
You know, right. I mean, I was dazzled by the concept of it, and clearly so was Funimation. They licensed it, and I'm sure they're kind of wishing they hadn't now.
Well, you know, I don't know, who knows? Like, I would imagine putting that name on a box, and if you make the cover art, you know, controversial enough, maybe it'll rope in some more people, but I don't know. A lot of people liked it a lot more than I did. They, you know, when I was complaining about it first, you know, right when it ended, a lot of people were like, well, no, you know, I appreciated what it was trying to say. So it's not like the dislike for this thing is universal.
I was reading up on some other opinions on it, just because I didn't, you know, I didn't feel that it was universally despised, mm-hmm. like I felt it should be. So I was looking at you know, other people's reasons why they liked it. And a lot of people brought up the artistry, which I thought was good, but not noteworthy.
The show isn't particularly fun to look at.
The character designs are fairly ugly.
Well, and the color palette's just gray and brown.
Right. I mean, it's not meant to be showy. I mean, technically, yeah, it's executed very well. None of the no shots really took my breath away or anything. It's not any sort of real feast for the eyes in any sense.
No. And, I mean,
you know, there were lots of reused shots because it is a TV show.
Yeah, it's a well-made show, but, you know, it's Watanabe. That is the least we expect.
It's Watanabe and it's MAPPA.
Yeah, right. So, I don't know. Well, anyway, so moving on, I guess you gave me three things. Let's start with Heroic Legend of Arslan, I guess.
Yeah, now this is going to be rebooted soon based on the Hiromu Arakawa mangaization of the original novel.
Yeah.
But this is the original that was kind of loosely inspired by the Yoshitaka Amano illustrations in the book.
Yeah, so I guess this is sort of considered like a fantasy classic in Japan, the book.
Mm.
And this is an OVA that I believe was released by Central Park Media.
Yes, it was.
And you
first
just...
First one's a movie.
Oh, okay, right. And you actually just gave me the first part to watch.
Right. After that, they go downhill pretty fast.
Yeah, and I've always heard that only watch the first one. It's good. The rest of it sucks, but it's, you know, that first part's really something. And, yeah, I agree. I think now that we're sort of saturated with fantasy content like this, it's a little less special, like, story-wise. It felt like it was sort of Game of Thrones by way of Lodoss War. Like, you know, that's kind of what it felt like to me. Very Game of Thrones-esque.
Right.
That's what I got from it. So story-wise, it is Warring Kingdoms, Prince, king of the biggest, you know, kingdom around, basically gets felled by an insider who betrays him. Prince gets exiled, and a band of heroes sort of forms to take the kingdom back and put him back in his rightful place. There's a few other reveals in there, but, you know, if you have any interest in watching it, maybe don't spoil yourself on it too much.
Right.
But the thing that I thought was really cool about this was the artistry in it. I really love it when somebody tries to take the cover illustrations, like concept art illustrations or cover art from like pulp science fiction novels or fantasy novels, and just tries to make that move. And it's one of the things that you only see in anime. And the closest analog is like Space Adventure Cobra, like the movie. This had a lot of that. Moments where it's just for pure illustrative style. They will take you on a little visual flight of fancy in the middle of a scene. And there's a lot of transitions that are really artistic. And it all feels like it is coming off the page of a really lavishly illustrated fantasy novel. And it's very impressive. There's a few shots in particular that I thought were just gorgeous. To me, that's the quality of this. The story, whatever, it was fine.
Nothing all that memorable, let's face it.
Yeah, but in terms of illustrating Amano's work, this is one of the best things I think I've seen visually. People have tried to do that a lot, and, you know, Vampire Hunter D being sort of like the most famous example, this is much more pure in terms of just bringing his illustrations to life. And from that angle, I enjoyed it a lot. I don't think it had much else going for it in terms of quality.
Yeah, this is a movie I recommend purely for its visuals and its sense of mood.
Yeah.
I really this movie, it came out as a double feature with the first Silent Mobius movie.
Okay.
Which I can only imagine what a ticket that was, because Silent Mobius, that's another indescribably pretty, lavishly animated, you know, story not all that great piece of work.
Right.
But, you know, that would have been just a mind-blowing 2 hours to sit through. This one, it was the main animation director on this was Kazuchika Kise. And that dude, he was the animation director for pretty much every major high-budget production IG movie in the 90s.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Ghost in the Shell, Jinro, all those. This is him, I think, kind of being given the most creative power he's ever been given. And you can see it in all these, like, meticulously hand-rendered moving camera shots. That opening shot where it's just, you know, Arslan in the fog. Always just that makes my attention snap to, and it never ebbs for the whole rest of the film.
Hmm.
And there are a couple even just still shots that just take my breath away. The story, I mean, it's Yoshiki Tanaka that wrote it, the Legend of Galactic Heroes dude.
Oh, okay.
I'm really beginning to think that Emperor has no clothes.
I never got through Legend of the Galactic Heroes, so I don't know. But
I got a little further than you did, and I think it from what I could tell, it was just more of the same. Mm-hmm. It was he really likes his written chess games.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely the thing I took away from it. I thought the pacing was pretty good, and like in terms of structure, it was perfectly fine. It's just that it's just not a novel bone in its body in terms of the story. But yeah, I think you're right. Like Legend of the Galactic Heroes is basically just a really big chess game, and you know that can be fun. It can certainly be fun to watch. But once you sort of see what's going on, and especially if he does that over and over and over again, I can see maybe the shine coming off of that a little bit.
Right, and you know, I've seen a number of adaptations of his other works, and I'm like, oh wow, he really doesn't have any other stories to tell.
Here's that story in space.
Juxtaposed on 90s Earth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but at any rate, I like the general story. I like this was actually inspired by the actual legend of Arslan, who was a Persian prince back in, I think, the some, you know, centuries old antiquity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the usual anime fantasy. I took a bunch of these real historical figures and just kind of put them in a snow globe,
mm-hmm,
together and, you know, shook them up. But it just, I just enjoy the look of it. I enjoy how pretty everyone is.
Yeah.
Everyone is ludicrously pretty.
Right. It's kind of the Amano way, though. He doesn't really draw ugly people.
Right. Now, did you watch the dub or the sub?
I watched the subtitle.
Okay. Yeah, the dub is interesting because it was a manga UK dub, you know, so London cast, but they actually kept their Londoner accents.
Oh, really? Okay.
But at the same time, okay, so they were working off, so all these names, everyone's name in the script is a katakana-ized Iranian name.
Really? Okay.
Right. Arslan Fergus, or like some sort of name from that, from the Middle East in that period. So then when they translated it, and, you know, this was way before Wikipedia and everything, they, whoever the translator was, they just kind of, they couldn't really look anything up all that easily, so they just kind of guessed as to what they were trying to do with the katakana. And then when that script was sent to the dub people who weren't in contact with the translator, they just sort of guessed as to how what the translator wrote was supposed to be read. So when they dubbed it, they really mangled these names. They're not, you can't tell what some people were supposed to be originally told, called. And then when CPM licensed the last two episodes that came out as OVAs, the licensor went, oh, by the way, this is how everything is supposed to be written in English. Nothing matches.
Wow. It's all just
nothing matches. Different. So they had to go through and edit all the old subtitle scripts, but the dub is just always going to be like that. So.
Wow. That's something. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm glad I saw it. I don't have any intention on watching the rest of it, I don't think.
Like, you don't need to.
I got, you know, I figured it I mean, I hate to keep drawing the comparison because they really don't have much in common, but it does remind me a little bit of Lotus War, where the first episode is kind of exciting and it's pretty well done, and the animation budget's obviously really high. I assume the budget drops off a cliff after this.
Oh, my God. You have no idea. I mean, two isn't terrible, because that was also released as a movie. Mm-hmm. 3 and 4 looked like it was animated on a lunch budget.
Okay, yeah. I figured. That seems to be, I guess, like they sort of mirror each other that way.
Yeah.
For 90s fantasy OVAs.
I think, I don't have the timeline exactly down, but it might have been a victim of the whole mess with Haruki Katakawa getting arrested.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, this whole thing was a Katakawa shindig, so. Huh. One last note. God, I love the ending theme.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I liked it, too. It's of its time, for sure.
Yeah, definitely, but very pretty, and also the orchestra soundtrack is just amazing.
Yeah.
Very full orchestra, not the sort of thing you get in anime these days.
Yeah, it's definitely a product of its time, like I said. But yeah, the hearing like the full orchestra in anything is really, it's like a treat now, like, because it just never happens. Like, no one wants to spend money on that. So
I would consider this like anime's Ben Hur.
If it were a complete story and the complete story were really good, sure. I guess like that. Okay. It's only an hour. It's only 48 minutes or whatever.
That's a full hour, I think.
That's, yeah, okay. I figure anime's Ben-Hur is, you know, at least a complete story. I don't know. Maybe I will go. Maybe I'll, you know, fast forward through the rest of it just to see how it ends. I don't know. I appreciate it. It's one of those things that I just never got around to, and it's always been a little bit of a mystery to me. It's like, I wonder how that is.
I'm sure had you seen it back in, you know, your formative years, you would have been a lot more impressed by it.
Yeah, well, story-wise, sure. Like, especially in the days before total saturation of material like this. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. But now it's kind of like, oh, it's like this. All right. Well, we get plenty of this stuff now, so, you know.
It is true. Yeah, we do.
In terms of the illustrative style, in terms of the art, it's definitely unique, and I can see why people really were drawn to it. And I can totally see how watching something like that, especially in the, you know, the 90s, it would have been like, well, this is completely unlike anything that ever gets produced in America. Like, nothing like this ever shows up in American animation, like illustration for illustration's sake. That's, yeah, never happens.
I really wish they'd do a new transfer. That old ratty Letterboxd SD transfer is looking pretty nasty these days.
Yeah, is there like a Blu-ray in Japan? Nope. Maybe they'll do one in advance of the new version.
I hope so. I hope they didn't lose the rights. Sometimes that happens.
Oh, so it'll just be lost forever?
It does happen where the original creator will kind of take their toys and go home if they weren't satisfied with the original adaptation.
Oh.
It'd take them to somewhere else, and whoever made the original the first adaptation, they just can't do anything with it anymore. That does happen.
Well, I'm curious to see Arakawa's take on it. I like her work, obviously, so, you know, we'll see.
Mm.
I hope that the thing is, though, like, knowing that it's Arakawa, of course it's not going to match the artistry on this thing at all.
No. I've seen what her manga looks like, and it looks like Arakawa.
Yeah, so super simplistic line art and stuff like that.
Yeah, like, you could transplant it with, what was that really mediocre thing that she had a few seasons ago?
Silver Spoon?
No. The some sort of battle in antiquity show.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. I was about to say, I didn't think Silver Spoon was mediocre, but yeah, I know what you're talking about, and I don't remember the name of it.
Hero so. Something or other.
Yeah. Yeah.
it says something we don't even remember.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so moving on. The next thing was Time of Eve, which I should point out, there's a podcast that just went up this morning. We're taping this on a Friday that expresses how I feel about Time of Eve. It's a whole show about it, in fact, with the woman who...
I listened to it. You spent a good 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah. So I really like Time of Eve, which is, I guess, is no surprise because everybody really likes this movie, everyone who's seen it. It was the Blu-ray came out because of a Kickstarter that like totally destroyed its goal. Like, I think their goal was like $18,000 and they raised like $200,000 or something like that.
Yeah, it was crazy.
And full disclosure, you did the authoring on the Blu-ray for this.
Yes, I did.
So everyone should know that. You've already been paid and you don't profit from further sales, so it doesn't matter.
I don't think they're going to hire me for anything else because they don't have anything else upcoming.
Yeah. Well, she said next year they're going to announce something. So this film is about a not-so-distant future in which humanoid, artificially intelligent robots are sort of the norm as like a servant class. They exist. They have these little electronic rings above their heads. And they just follow people around and do what they want. And society kind of treats them like shit. They're pushy and they treat them like objects. They treat them like you would treat a vacuum cleaner or a dishwasher, not like a person. And it turns out quietly, these artificially intelligent servants have developed a full range of human emotions. And that, I think, is the strongest thing about Time of Eve. The way that that is expressed, the way that that's revealed to the audience, that... these servant robots now have the full spectrum of human emotion. There's a couple of scenes that illustrate that really, really well. And I thought it was remarkably well made and pretty for a low, you know, not a high budget production. It looks really good. Some of the segments are better than others, and I think you can definitely tell that it was originally an ONA series and that this is sort of stitched together individual episodes. I think the strongest material is the connective tissue that brings everything together. But yeah, I really liked it. I can see why people really enjoyed it. I was a little surprised that, because after I finished it, my chief thought was, boy, people must really clamor for more of this. Because... In my opinion, and some of the feedback I got, like Mike Toole was like, it felt like a complete story to me. And I'm like, yeah, but there's like they don't conclude really anything at all. It doesn't wrap much up aside from that cafe gets to stay open.
Right.
And it all centers around the main character, the two main characters who find this cafe where there's no discrimination allowed between humans and robots. They're all just supposed to interact with each other as though everyone is human.
Right, the robots turn their rings off, and beyond that, you can't really even tell who's who.
Yeah, you cannot tell, aside from, you know, occasionally, like, one of their limbs will start freaking out or something, but that's it. Otherwise, they're completely human in mannerism and in expression. And over time, they sort of slowly learn about, you know, how these robots have developed and get to know a few of the cafe regulars, and you know, there's a segment where one of the leads has an at-home sort of simplistic robot that also had developed human emotion. Like, it wasn't just based on being a humanoid version, who loved him very much and, you know, was forced by his father, who is the leader of the ethics committee, which is responsible for all this anti-robot propaganda. Like, don't treat them like humans. You know, that's what the government's telling people. And that's all very touching, and I liked that. I liked that a lot. I felt like it was a much warmer, and I said this in the other podcast, warmer and a much more empathetically focused version of that Spielberg movie, Artificial Intelligence.
AI.
Yeah, which I like that movie a lot. A lot of people don't like that movie. I like it a lot.
I don't care for it.
Yeah, well, it's Spielberg making a Kubrick film, so, you know. Their styles aren't compatible.
No, they're not. That and a very old Kubrick script that was outdated well before that movie was made.
Yeah, right, exactly. But it reminded me of that movie a lot, but I thought it was better in terms of giving us something to care about, giving us something to latch onto. And like I said, I really thought the reveal... Oh, sorry if you can hear that. It is pouring ass rain outside. The reveal that these robots had developed human emotion was was really good. I was very impressed with it.
You know, when I was watching this movie, I am not sure, and I am not making the statement that this was even an intentional analog that the director was trying to make, but I couldn't help but think constantly of how Japan treats Koreans.
Oh, really?
It worked. It's almost a perfect comparison. Imagine being raised in a really, you know, left-wing home or right-wing home, sorry. A very right-wing home that, you know, you've been taught your entire life that they're the ones that are in the country are here to serve us. They don't, you know, they're not human. They don't have emotions. And then you stumble on a gathering place where you can't tell who's who and you really can't. You know, you might be able to guess here and there, but you're just guessing. And, you know, if you know, a lot of Koreans grew up in Japan, a lot of Koreans, you know, were even born in Japan, but, you know, can't be naturalized. But in a place where no one's allowed to discriminate, suddenly everything you've been taught, the walls just come right down. And I think this is really an incredible look at the psychology of people kind of learning that what they were grown up, what they were taught to believe growing up is just completely in the wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point. That did not occur to me at all, but I think if you want to use it as kind of an analogy for that, that might be good for like a classroom setting or something. That's a really good point. I think I'll, you know, stay with a sort of surface reading.
Sure.
But yeah, that's cool. I'm glad that this found such an audience, such a wide audience. I would like to see more. I think that the ending is left pretty open, and I'd be curious to see what his take on, like, I kind of want to see him write out the development of that society as more people discover that their robots have human emotions. How society would deal with that,
right.
Like at large. I'd be interested in the larger social commentary on something like that. So I would love to see more, but you know, who knows?
In the meantime, it has some really amazing and really touching and very well realized character moments.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
It's extremely, extremely well written. Lots of nuance. I was so disappointed in Padma Inverted, his next movie.
Because
it had none of that.
Yeah, that was mostly just spectacle, right?
Yeah, spectacle, and it was so very much for kids, you know, cackling evil villain and the whole thing.
Oh, okay.
You know, much more simplistic worldview. This is very much a story for mature, you know, not necessarily adults, but at least mature teenagers.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it has a very real respect for you know, subtle nuances in how people act, and it's very observant of that, and that's something we need more of in anime, frankly.
Yeah, Yeah, I agree. It didn't like totally blow me away or anything. Certainly the ideas have been explored before, but I really liked the focus on empathy. And that to me made it special. That made it different. I was less interested in the tech side of it and more interested in just the exploration of empathy and what that means and all of that stuff. It was a really special film. I'm glad I saw it. I don't think I'll go, you know, watch the original episodes or anything. I'm sure I don't really need to, having seen the film.
It's, you know, very little. Yeah. I mean, it's almost nothing on the cutting room floor.
Right.
I just want to note that, my parents were visiting me a couple months ago and I popped this in cause I'd just gotten the disc.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up watching the whole thing with me. They really enjoyed it.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I actually, like, as an anime movie, I think this is one of those that you could generally give to a pretty wide audience, pretty broad audience, and they'd get something out of it. It's a shame that there was never any exposure for it in film festivals or anything, but I think this is something that could have gotten attention from that crowd.
I think the fact that it's very obviously six episodes stitched together and not a real arc would have kind of crowbarred it in the festival circuit.
Maybe you're right. But I guess what I'm saying is I think it has broad appeal.
Yeah, I agree.
So that's that. Really liked it. You can purchase it, actually. You can go to timeofeve.com and buy it if you want to see it. And I believe the original episodes are still streaming, like on Crunchyroll or whatever. But after that, he gave me the Humanoid, which is a 45-minute sci-fi OVA from the 90s.
80s.
80s. Oh, was it like 88 or something like that?
No, 86, I think.
Oh, really? Okay. Also a CPM release, I'm pretty sure.
Yep.
And when I turned it on, Hope was in the room and she goes, "Oh, Justin gave you this. You don't say."
My reputation precedes me.
Yeah, I think it's when the theme song starts that she said that, actually. With that really, really weird title card that I assume CPM made.
Yeah.
With flashing colors and like a Photoshop filter.
Yep.
Anyway, so this is the story of, in the future, there's an invading race. You explain it.
Okay. In the distant future on planet Liz area, there are basically two different races living in harmony, but one evil prince wants to unearth these ancient ruins that caused all this cataclysm before so he can have all the power in the universe. Meanwhile, the governor, who's kind of a nice old dude, he's and his daughter Sherry is awaiting these space traveler guys, one of whom she's engaged to, and they get mixed up in the plot, and the only person who can save the day is Sherry's basically servant robot, Antoinette.
Okay.
Who looks a lot like Robot Maria from Metropolis.
Yep. And wouldn't you know it, they save the day.
Yes.
So this is old, and it's a big product of its time. This is from the era when people would just spend money to make... You know, not, I wouldn't say it's lavishly animated, but it's not poorly animated. Science fiction one-shot OVAs. What were their intentions for more of this, or was it just a one-off?
No, just a one-off. I can't find evidence that this director ever worked on anything else ever.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. So I have to ask, why did you give me the Humanoid? I got almost nothing out of it, aside from I was laughing at how the villain... Like, so you gave me this dubbed, and the dub the dub is pretty great in terms of just being cheesy as fuck.
Right, and that's why I gave it to you, because it's the whole thing is great in terms of being cheesy as fuck.
I found it kind of dull. Like, I wasn't particularly taken with it, like, in terms of the story. Like, the story isn't doesn't really have a lot of what the fuck kind of stuff in it. The story.
No, it's not that kind of hokey.
Pretty straightforward. But in terms of like corny dub for sort of rote old sci-fi thing, yeah, that was amusing. Like the bad guy, I wonder, like, he has one of those bad guy voices where you wonder how he gets through life doing anything and if anyone takes him seriously ever. Because, like, all of his lines are delivered like this. And
you just imagine the supermarket checkout, I'll be paying on MasterCard.
Yeah, really. I'll have a number two. Like, yeah, it's really, really bad.
Extra cheese.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you serious? I swear I'm serious about this. You sound like you're maybe not. Yeah, so corny, super corny dub, but it definitely, like, watching it, especially the songs, I was like, I think I know why Justin likes this.
I will never say that this is a good show.
Mm-hmm.
I love it so.
Yeah.
It is so cheesy and over the top, and like that, you know, the big rollicking 80s power rock ballad when, you know, Antoinette comes to save the day. I don't think I'm really giving anything away by saying that.
No.
which is literally called Power of Love in English.
Uh-huh.
That also totally rips off the guitar riff from Owner of a Lonely Heart.
Oh yeah. I was wondering. I was like, what is that song?
Yeah, it's I don't know. It just all congeals for me into this big cheesy 80s love angst spectacle, and I just kind of want to fill a bathtub with it and lay in it.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely has that. I didn't not enjoy it. I guess I just walked away from it with kind of a one of those.
Yeah.
And I'm glad they exist. But
when you really think about it, there's not that many one of those.
No, I guess it just feels like, because I think I've seen most of them at this point. So I've seen the six of them that exist or whatever, seven or eight.
Yeah. I think the production history is kind of interesting. This was a co-production between a company called Hero Media, which made a bunch of really terrible early OVAs before going out of business, you know, things like MD Geist, and Kaname Pro, which had a very distinctive art style back in the day, and they're known for shows like Windaria and Fantastic Adventures of Yoko Lita. Everything that they did had this very cherubic art style to it, mostly because of the character designer Mitsumi Inomata. No, that was her name. So the character designer Mitsumi Inomata was just, she designed almost everything that studio produced, and they didn't do anything that was, you know, truly mind blowing by today's standards, but they did a lot of really kind of nice high-end anime of the mid-80s that I think is kind of underappreciated today. And also, Antoinette was designed by the guy that designed the Sony Aibo Robot Gog.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and was actually a fairly well-known sexy robot painter. That was kind of an artistic thing in the 80s, that Aerosmith album cover.
Yeah,
was actually inspired by his work.
I figured, yeah.
Yeah.
It was like a pinball thing. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was it was an interesting little piece. I just had a lot of fun with it, and also I really enjoyed how the coffee emphasized their obsession, or yeah, the dub emphasized their obsession with coffee.
Yeah, they kept bringing it up. Like, I laughed out loud a couple of different times every time that whoever that is playing the lead character, it's not the lead, I guess, I don't know, he's a narrator? Like, what would you call that guy? He's a supporting cast, sort of.
Lionel Richie.
Yeah, right. Yes, every time he would talk, it was sort of hilariously overwritten, I think, is the word for it. But yeah, he was really obsessed with this fucking coffee.
They amped that up a little bit in the dub, and then on the DVD, we had a lot of fun on this DVD because first of all, there's just this running commentary from the DVD editor or the DVD producer of just random stuff on a subtitle track. So like the bald guy would come up and then you'd get a list of famous bald guys.
Well then, how helpful.
Yeah, it's just, it's completely random, and the producer of that DVD, Michael Palin, wrote it, and it's really a lot of fun. And then there's also a hidden coffee montage where we just took all the really ludicrous scenes of coffee and just made it a thing.
There's a lot of awkward group laughing, too. So, like, somebody will say something and they'll go, ha ha ha, and then it goes, ah, ha 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 ha, and then everyone around the table, ah, ha 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 ha, and that happens, like, a lot.
That was kind of an 80s cartoon thing.
It was. you're right. So, yeah, you know what? It was pretty enjoyable. Like, I don't know. I guess I was just sort of in a kind of a, all right, another one of these. But at the same time, I realize this is sort of a tradition at this point where you give me at least one weird,
cheesy 80s thing.
Yeah, cheesy, really cornball 80s thing. And I do enjoy watching them. So hopefully you've got at least another one another one left.
I'm really going to have to rack my brain next year.
Yeah.
Yes, 3 for 3 then.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, all of them. I have not regretted watching a single one of them. So, all right. So that does it for anime, actually. So as per usual, we also swapped a bunch of movies. Same rules, 3 each. Let's start with what you gave me.
Okay.
She gave me 3 things, none of which I had seen, one of which I had always meant to see. And let's start with that one. So the first thing you gave me was Francis Ha, which is part of the Criterion Collection now. It is a Noah Baumbach film from a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I think 2013, actually. I think it's just last year.
Last year. Yeah, I know. I think you're right. It is a black and white movie about Greta Gerwig, a sort of indie darling actress, after appearing in such films as Greenberg and a few others. And it is chiefly sort of about a, I think the Netflix description is a ambitious sort of aspiring dancer with more, I don't know, gusto than actual talent, who is basically trying to make it in New York City. And her sort of foibles in so much as trying to accomplish that. Chiefly, this is it's a Noah Baumbach film. So if you're not familiar with his work, he directed most famously, I think, the film Kicking and Screaming and The Squid and the Whale. He's directed a few other things, but he's a frequent collaborator of Wes Anderson, one of my favorite directors. So it's weird that I hadn't seen this yet, because I usually see Noah Baumbach movies just about right when they come out.
Yeah, I was really kind of shocked you hadn't. So I was like, oh, well, geez, yes, this.
Yeah, and to it, I really liked it a lot. I thought it was a really great portrait of someone who is aging out of their 20s. So getting into, I think she's like 27 or 28 in this film.
Right.
And she does not have her shit together at all. She is basically couch surfing. She lives with her best friend who is getting her shit together in terms of, you know, at least superficially, her best friend. The film spends a lot of time on the friendship between these two characters. And to me, it felt very authentic. Girls, women in their mid to late 20s, I've experienced their friendship to be, this was, it felt authentic to me. And her best friend sort of has to move and meets a fiance who's, you know, really got his life together. And the title character just really doesn't, and kind of bounces around, winds up sleeping on somebody's couch for a while, has money troubles, winds up kind of trying to figure out what she wants to do with her life. And really her existential crisis is triggered by her friend kind of getting her shit together. And they start drifting apart. And I thought it was, as a portrait of people in their late 20s who are trying to become adults, I really liked it. And I thought it was a delightfully positive film that was also honest about the way these folks are, the emotions that they're dealing with, how they handle them. And Greta Gerwig's a great actress. I find her to be a welcome presence in just about anything. And she was really good in this. So yeah, I mean, it's really good. It's on Netflix. It's only like an hour and a half. I think it's sort of essential viewing for anyone who's at that age and is struggling a little bit.
Yeah, this is the definitive I'm young and struggling in New York movie.
But it's not just full of ennui.
No, in a heartwarming, this is, I would rather be doing nothing else sort of way.
Yeah, it's life affirming, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I lived this life and I was flashing back constantly while watching this movie.
Did you really? I mean, you always had a stable career for the most part. I mean, you weren't necessarily going from couch to couch.
No, I mean, I was never that completely messed up, but I was, you know, I was broke. I mean,
yeah, right.
CPM was paying me 30 grand a year to live in New York City.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, I was barely scraping by. I was like, I was a whole month behind on my rent at one point. So yeah, I related very strongly to this movie. So yeah, it's very personal for me. But it also made me realize something, and that is that to the rest of the world, it's really interesting, and it never had occurred to me before that chasing your dreams could look to everyone else like horrifying immaturity, like utter arrested development. Because you are, in fact, giving up what everyone else considers a normal, stable adult life for the sake of your dreams.
Yeah, and especially if that dream happens to be a career in the arts, everyone's right. going to look at you like, not only are you wildly irresponsible, but your dream is dumb and unobtainable and based on bullshit fantasies of stardom anyway.
Right.
So, yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I think the film does a pretty remarkable job of diffusing that and showing you that, yeah, it's going to be tough, but you can do it if you work hard enough and you really apply yourself. And like, she has to have like a pretty big meltdown, a pretty big crash down to reality before realizing, because at the beginning of the film, she's making a lot of dumb choices.
Oh yeah.
And choices where it's like, you know, so the dance studio that she's hoping to get a spot in, but, you know, does some work there and practices there and everything, but she's hoping to get a spot in the troupe there. She's offered a job as the, you know, when she gets rejected from the troupe, she's offered a job as the receptionist, which is like, holy shit, take the job. And she doesn't because it's not dancing and that's not what she wants to do. But that's the kind of dumb choice you make when you're in your late 20s and you're like, no, my vision is pure. And like, she makes a dumb choice, but then later in the film, after she sort of realizes, oh, I should work with what my strengths are and get to my lofty dream in a realistic way.
Right.
She ultimately, you know, winds up taking a job and putting her own show together. And, yeah, it was just, I thought it was kind of like, hey, your totally unrealistic dreams and are going to kind of fuck you for a while, but if you approach them realistically, you can totally do it.
Big warm hug of a movie. I really, really love this film.
Yeah, I had a hard time kind of not seeing it as a love letter because Greta Gerwig is Noah Baumbach's girlfriend.
Right.
And the movie is a total love letter to her. Like, she is just... it's about how lovable she is to a large extent. At no point does she become unsympathetic or anything. There's a sequence where she sort of on a whim decides to go to Paris. Like, she just takes out a credit card and goes to Paris because she feels like there's no spontaneity like that in her life, I guess. And
which is true, but, you know, that's a luxury.
Yeah, that's a luxury. But it's the kind of decision that's relatable. Like, I'm not saying I would have done that, but I certainly know plenty of people who have done crazy irresponsible shit like that. And it turned out, you know, it was a bad idea in the first place. She went, like, for, like, 2 days. Jet lag made it, so she slept through most of it. And she wound up kind of regretting it. But I don't know. It just was very realistic look at a person in that point in their life. And yeah, really good stuff. I'm really glad I saw it.
Just a footnote, like I actually blind bought the Criterion Blu-ray on a sale.
Oh yeah.
Cuz you know, Criterion Blu-ray is 50% off, you have to buy something. And so I'd always meant to see this film. It had gotten such rave reviews. I'm just like, okay, got it. Watched it some night. And I was like, oh my God, great. And then I flipped through the special features and holy shit, there was a conversation on there. Noah Baumbach talking with, I forget the name of this director, but he played Dr. Melfi's psychiatrist on The Sopranos.
Oh, okay.
Old dude, who apparently works with them very closely, and it is the douchiest conversation I have ever witnessed.
Yeah, I like Noah Baumbach's films, but I don't want to hang out with him.
No, oh my God, that special feature is just insufferable.
It's funny, I think Noah Baumbach is like, he is kind of the alternate world Wes Anderson, whereas Wes Anderson went on, now he's making big comedies that are wildly successful, and they have an edge to them and there's a style to them, but they are just enjoyable comedies. Baumbach is making the kind of movies I think people think Wes Anderson makes. You know, and they're heavy collaborators, so that stands to reason. But he seems kind of like maybe the guy who takes himself too seriously.
You think?
Yeah, and is making the kind of Francis Ha, I think, is a standout difference, and I think it was made with a lot of love in it, and it's a very positive. But go back and watch The Squid and the Whale. I mean, fuck.
Yeah, there's a reason I hesitated before seeing it, because I don't really like Noah Baumbach movies.
Yeah, I mean, Kicking and Screaming at this point, I feel like that movie's been remade. In terms of, you know, the cast of characters and what it's trying to say about a certain time in youth. And I think this movie is a refinement of what he was saying in Kicking and Screaming, and much more positive and much more upbeat, and I think much more realistic. But, yeah, I assume this movie came from a place of love, and you can really tell.
Right.
But Noah Baumbach himself...
Yeah.
I don't know. but, yeah, so thanks for recommending that. Okay, so after that, you gave me an Ozu film, Late Spring, which I had never seen. I've seen some Ozu before, not a lot. And this is blasphemous to say, but I am not a big fan of Ozu.
I'm not entirely shocked, but I had to try.
Yeah, well, I've seen some of his films before, never this one. This one is considered by a lot of people to be one of his masterpieces.
Yeah, it's either this or Tokyo Story.
Yeah, which are two parts of what's considered a trilogy of films about single women in post-war Japan. So Late Spring simultaneously intrigued and infuriated me. It infuriated me for the same reasons every Ozu movie infuriates me, which is I just don't like the whole let's stare at this tree for 10 seconds before moving on. Let's take 2 hours to express like three different emotions. At one point they start talking about going to the No Theater, and I'm like, no.
You've been waiting to make that joke, haven't you?
It's not. No, that's how I felt while I was watching the film. I was like,
I'm not saying it's not, but
please don't go to the No Theater. And they go to the No performance, and of course the camera just fucking sits there, and you're like, ah. But as like with most of his films, I may not personally appreciate his particular style, which is worshipped by cineasts the world over. But usually he's saying something very interesting, or at least presenting a multifaceted set of ideas. And this movie, it's interesting. It was made in 1949, so literally, you know, during Reconstruction, and henceforth was, you know, subject to all the American censorship of the time, because there was a board of Americans approving these movies, right? And this film went through that. And as such, it is sort of an argument about conservatism to an extent, and hanging on to the traditions of the past and the value of hanging on to the traditions of the past. But it's also a tragedy So the basic story is Noriko, which is interesting. So the three films that this is sort of part of a cycle all are about a single woman named Noriko, but it's not the same character.
Right. It's played by the same woman.
Played by the same woman, but it's not the same character. She is living with her father, who's a widower, and really loves her life living with her father, but the pressure is on to get married. And so everyone starts pressuring her to get married. They set her up with a guy, and she keeps saying, well, you know, I'd be happy just living with my dad and living out the rest of my life like that. You know, I'm happy here. I don't see why that should have to change. And her father eventually tells her, well, I'm going to get remarried, so you have to get married. You have to get married. You have to move on. Everyone wants you to get married. You have to do it. And neither of them appear to want this to happen, although you're not given hints about the father's feelings about it necessarily until closer to the end of the film. But eventually she gives in, gets married, and that's the end of the film. The end is a tragedy because neither of them wanted this really to happen. The final shot is her father living with the choice that he made, which is sort of caving into the demands of society, even though he was happier with her around, she was happier, and, you know, at that point in time, more free living with him than she would have been getting married to a dude. And so, you know, you can take it a couple of different ways, like most Ozu films. I don't know if he's making an argument for hanging on to tradition and basically saying, like, all these changes that are happening aren't necessarily for the good, and doing what society is telling you is the best thing to do is not necessarily what's going to make you happy. And, you know, or it's an argument in favor of, I don't know, old-ass Japanese values. That, you know, a lot of which were erased during Reconstruction. In that sense, I appreciated it. The act of sitting through it was, you know, it was tough, like every Ozu movie is, for me anyway. What do you think of this thing?
I didn't have trouble sitting through this at all, and there are Ozu films I do have trouble with. This is not one of them.
Yeah.
I really was... First of all, the tragedy of it, the apple scene at the end.
Yeah.
Just, that's a kick in the balls. That was just devastating to watch. And so much of it is the performance of the actors, Chishuryu, who's the father, who's like, I think he was near the same age as the girl who played his daughter, Setsuko Hara. Setsuko Hara also being one of the main inspirations behind Millennium Actress.
Yeah, I could tell.
Yeah. That whole, you know, working her ass off through the post-war years and then going into retirement and being a recluse, that's totally what happened with her. But at any rate, I got such a feeling of connection between those two. Like, they didn't have to sell me at all on that family relationship. That was a happy family relationship, and I think what you really see there is a really happy family relationship that is literally torn apart by the force of tradition. Right. No one is happy at the end, and that was an incredible statement back then, because there was a whole lot of pushback against, you know, the modernization that was coming with the influx of, you know, the Americans. And, you know, part of that was, you know, how hard do we hold on to this tradition? And this was, I think, a very clear statement that not every tradition makes us happy.
Yeah, I think so. I think you could read it a different way.
Sure.
Noriko is, like, wildly conservative, and jealousy is sort of the other strong emotion that she has going on. But her values are very traditional, and at no point is she ever, like, her values are very traditional. At no point are those values ever questioned or really challenged at all.
Yes, but at the same time, she's kind of a modern girl, isn't she? Where, you know, her friends are coming over. Her room is the least Japanese room in the house. They're drinking English style tea with milk.
She's a modern on the surface and not at all beneath the surface, I don't think. I mean, I guess you could make the argument that if she were, then she would be as concerned with getting married as everyone else is. But I don't know. Maybe I'm reading this because I know Ozu was, like, hyper-conservative. Like, that guy did not like what America was doing.
Right. No.
And, you know, that he rejected a lot of that stuff.
He did.
And so it's hard to read this as some kind of like, oh, we don't need those old traditions, because he loved the old traditions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I have a hard time reading the film that way. I don't think he would have been trying to say that. But I think you're right in that it's like, well, not all of them are worth hanging on to. In particular, you know, forcing somebody, basically making ourselves unhappy at the service of tradition. So I don't know, maybe he thought that this is the kind of movie that would get past the censorship board. But, yeah, no, it definitely gives you a lot to think about, I think. I'm curious to see the other two films in the trilogy. You know, as much as I don't like his style, I'm still curious what he might have been saying in those films. And that was the joy of this one for me, was figuring out, okay, what is he saying? And his what's weird to me is that, you know, of the criticism that I read on it, one of the major through lines that everyone kept saying is like, oh, it's such a complete portrait of a person. It's like, you know, it's an achievement in character for Japanese filmmaking. And I, like a lot of Ozu's movies, I feel like it's more about broad emotions, thought processes, principles, more than character. I thought the characters are sort of vessels by which he is expressing a message about the human condition.
I don't really agree with that.
Yeah, no, that's fine. You don't have to.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. That I think the characters are very well fleshed out. I really did feel like I knew them.
Really, you did? Okay. Yeah, I was a little distanced from them, but that might have been my reaction to his style. Like, his style is so formal that it's so formal and it's so static that I always feel like I'm never inside the world. I always feel like I'm watching it in a little box.
You know, his films are really, and this one in particular, I would kind of characterize as the act of watching them is sort of like just on a quiet afternoon having a nice cup of tea and just sitting quietly.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and that is not everyone's speed.
Nope, not mine. Well, not
but
always.
There are some afternoons I just really need that.
I like slow movies, but they have to be slow in a certain way. And this was just, like, the slowness needs to feature somehow thematically, I think. And for me, it's just all of his films are kind of like that. So the style of it just, once again, just didn't really reach me. But like I said, there was plenty in it to appreciate, and I did enjoy thinking about it. But I didn't really connect with the characters. I didn't really feel strongly about them as characters. To me, I was just sort of like, all right, well, where is this going? Like, what are they trying to say with this?
I see.
Maybe I was a little too focused on that, and I should have let myself get lost in the characters a little bit more. But, you know, he's also doing that thing where he puts the camera on the floor.
Yeah. So everything's at knee level.
Yeah, you're staring up at these faces through the entire film. Well, one thing I did notice, and while I was watching the film, I was like, you know, it gets to the scene where they go on a pilgrimage, sort of a little vacation, an overnight trip to a shrine. And her and her father have this conversation, and he reveals to her that he's going to get remarried. And that's sort of when she realizes she has to get married. Mm-hmm. And she's laying on the floor, staring at the ceiling, and she looks kind of happy. She's got kind of like a half smile going on. And then he cuts to this vase that's sitting in front of this shadow of a window. And the camera sits there for like 10 seconds, and it cuts back to her, and she's almost in tears, and then it cuts back to the vase for another like 12 seconds. And I said, you know what? I bet film scholars sit around and argue about this scene. And they do.
Yes. I was having a mental conversation with myself about the meaning of that very shot.
So what do you think of it? What do you think of
Well, when Ozu does that, and they're known as pillow shots, they tend to be there as like almost an intentional rest for, like, there's, you know, it's almost this rhythmic thing where it's like a quiet moment in a symphony where it just kind of builds anticipations. Like, you know, you're not being shown something intentionally, and your mind starts to go, what am I not seeing? So that, and then you see the shot of her looking really, really unhappy. That's when it clicks, like, oh, that was, that could have been A, what she was focusing on, just trying to keep it together.
Yeah.
That could have been, or maybe even not going that literal, that could have been just something for the camera to do while it invited us to think as her.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I think the most compelling argument I read was that he is showing us something that is permanent and not unchanged by time, and cutting back to a person who is affected by impermanence, and so she has to change. She has to change over time.
See, that's one of those things that I think film scholars overthink, but I really like that interpretation.
I liked it too. I thought it made a lot of sense. And he holds that shot for so long, and it's a traditional vase in front of a traditional window, and you can see like bamboo leaves and stuff. So it's a classical image of it's a classical Japanese image, something that is relatively unchanged by time. And then, but she has to change. And I agree with that reading. I wish it were my own, but I am not that smart. And I'm going with that. I think that shot was cool, and I kind of want, like, I would love a neon version of that vase shot on, like, a t-shirt. I think that would be fun.
Man, those are two styles that don't really clash.
Yeah, but I don't know. Just for weirdness' sake, I think it's cool.
It is weird.
Yeah, but yeah, it's, I immediately I'm like, oh man, I bet people argue about this a lot. Why is he holding on this vase for so long?
That's funny.
But those pillow shots, like you're talking about, there's a lot of them in this movie, and it's weird. It's sort of a part of his weird atonal style, where, like, you know, he'll have characters be like, hey, let's go to the gym, you know, for lack of a better word, or let's go to the park. And he shows them leaving for the park, and then he cuts to after they're done at the park. And he does this shit all the time. And he doesn't use transitions, like, at all. It's just, boom, you're in the next scene. Except for the pillow shots. So the pillow shots, they're not establishing shots. Sometimes they kind of serve both services, but mostly they are what you were talking about. Yeah, it's an interesting style. I mean, you have to like his style, I think, in order to get more out of it than I did. And I just never been that big on his thing. Like, he's so obsessed with the static camera, he would force his cameraman to walk in step with the actors so that it appears as though they are walking inside of a static box and the box is not moving. It's like, ugh. God damn it.
I don't blame you for being a little bit frustrated.
You know how I am. Like, it's got to be the exact right kind of slow, or I just start checking out.
Right.
And, you know, over time, that's changed a little bit. I have a higher tolerance for this stuff now, you know, and in large part thanks to the fact that we do these swaps and you give me all this stuff, and it's much slower. Like, your style of movie is so different from mine, so I appreciate, you know, having my mind expanded. And, you know, all the Ozu I ever saw was in college, and that was a long time ago at this point. So, you know, I haven't watched a lot since then, but this has sort of made me think, you know what, I may not like style, maybe a little slow, but I might go check out at least the other two in this trilogy.
So next year maybe I should give you some Fellini?
See, that stuff I've revisited, and I actually like Fellini more than Ozu.
Okay.
Anyway, so that was that. Let's see. The last thing was this one I'm baffled by. You gave me this movie called Clock Watchers, which is sort of an also-ran, little-known thing from the mid-90s, starring Parker Posey and Toni Collette, your favorite. Right. So immediately when she shows up, I'm like, I wonder why Justin gave me this movie. Lisa Kudrow. And who is the other lady?
Oh, Alana Ulbeck. She's not famous.
Well, no, she's a character actor. So I've seen her in plenty of stuff. Yeah. And this one was about drones in a credit card company, and
temps specifically.
Temp drones who work in this sort of oppressively plain, bland credit company. And Parker Posey plays kind of this sort of outspoken rebel type character. Toni Collette plays a kind of soft-spoken new girl who shows up and gets embroiled in this world. And office supplies start disappearing, and it introduces an atmosphere of paranoia into the office, and they start clamping down and telling people they can't do things at a certain time or whatever. It starts becoming very police state-like. And then the Parker Posey character kind of has a meltdown and gets blamed for all of it. And, why did you give me this film? Because I don't have any idea what you would have gotten out of it. I didn't get much out of it, other than I know you really like Toni Collette.
But this movie's kind of why.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. This movie is one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, I know.
Actually, of everything I was not expecting to connect with you, this is the last one on my list.
Really? Yeah, I thought it was... So my takeaway with it was that it felt like a product of its time to the point where it's not particularly relatable now, because they're in a big office building. Like, these kind of office space type movies, and I hate to compare it to that, but it is kind of like that was a thing in the mid-90s, was... office drone malaise was a big thing in the mid-90s. And companies don't operate like that. All these people would have been downsized in 1999. It's a little like that work environment, like, oh, we don't have anything to do because they overhire for tax breaks. And so we're all just kind of sitting around doing nothing. All these people would have been fighting for their lives to keep these shitty jobs. Like, it is... I think it's aged out of relevance, and that impacted me. Even as a product of its time, it felt very slight and kind of shallow. Hmm. I didn't think it was bad. I just thought it was super slight. So please tell me what I'm missing.
Okay. Basically the entire personal angle, which is the bulk of the movie. It's a story of office drones living kind of a miserable humdrum existence. Mm-hmm. But it's also the story of, it's almost like I thought of it as kind of a companion piece of Francis Ha. Like, this is the opposite end of that. This is what it's like to be around that age, aging out of your youth, but you don't have any passions in life. You don't really have any idea what you want to do, and you don't feel particularly good at anything. And for that world, this is sort of like – it's sort of like a dialed back Todd Sullins movie where everything is plain, everything is mundane, everything is just kind of quietly gross and oppressive. I mean, there's this one shot where Toni Collette's character is sitting in a bathroom stall eating the least appetizing sandwich in cinema history. And it just – it the oppression from like how badly that the – the office manager treats these people, how no one gives them any respect or even knows who they are. That's just living in this kind of sense of suspended animation where you just, you have no direction and you're just there, and it's misery. And I've never seen that captured so well before. Also, something that never happens in movies that was really kind of unique in this one, I didn't recognize it until I rewatched this before giving it to you, was nobody talks like a screenwriter. And I mean nobody. These are, I don't want to say these are dumb people, but they're not special people. They're not insightful people necessarily. They're just kind of people who are not good at what society tells them to be good at, which is finding a direction and going marching in that direction. The way they speak is exactly like ordinary people speak. Cliched metaphors, things that everyone says, and it's very true to life. Now, I'd go crazy if most movies were like that, but in a movie like this, which is very specific about its sense of place, its characterizations, and everything being just not special, it works, and it's kind of brilliant.
That's a good point about the dialogue. And I think the character action in particular, like character motivation and like what they do and why they do it, You know, there's a scene early on where they're at like a bar, and I thought the interactions there felt very true to life. Mm-hmm. Like, at no point did the film not feel authentic, I guess. So I guess that is a good point. The thing is that I feel like I've seen countless representations of shitty office drudgery in movies, and this didn't particularly feel more authentic or special than any of those. So I guess I didn't get that from it, and maybe if that's what really struck you about it, I didn't quite take that away from it. But what you're saying about, you know, being stuck, not having any particular hopes or dreams, not really knowing what you want to do, and actively, you know, the character in the film has an opportunity at a better job, but doesn't want to do it. She doesn't want to follow in her cartoon salesman father's footsteps.
Right, that her father is not a good actor.
Well, he's a character actor, and he's good in dumb comedies where he's supposed to be really broad, but not this.
Right. But, like, every line of his felt ADR'd. It was so out of place.
Oh, yeah. At one point, he's like, why? You could run a whole company. And I'm like, are you in a different movie? You're from a different movie. Like, what's going on? But, yeah, like, I don't know. I felt like it was all kind of in service of not much. Like, Parker Posey kind of takes the movie over. And, you know, she's fine. I like Parker Posey, but I don't know. I guess, like, that ennui has been done in other films, and I'd seen a lot of it, so this didn't feel special to me.
I didn't get a sense that the movie is about ennui.
Okay.
Ennui is a big part of it, certainly, but that's the setting, that's not the point.
Well, what do you think the point is, then? Because at the end, it's like, so Parker Posey turns out, like, didn't steal all that stuff, wasn't the person doing it, but gets blamed for it because she's standing out. And sort of rebelling. Like, she stole a few things, but she wasn't stealing everything.
Right.
And
she was being a bad girl. She wasn't being a thief.
Yeah, exactly. And but she doesn't want to leave without getting a recommendation for a better job. And Toni Collette sort of makes that happen for her and also confronts the actual thief. So
way
I guess.
To give away the ending, Zach.
I guess maybe she. Well, what are we going to do? Are we going to talk about these movies or not?
dance around a few spoilers here and there.
Well, people should see. This is one of those movies where what actually happens in it is not so much as important as the experience of watching it. I think.
I
think it's one of those films where it's like the Ozu film. You sit down, and the point is the atmosphere. You're just talking about that.
Sure. I think no. The point is Toni Collette's character arc.
Right, and what
where
do you think that
she basically, through her interactions with Margaret, Parker Posey's character, learns to doing what she did at the end is the first time she has done something in the whole movie that she has done something assertive to control what happens, where she actually takes destiny by the horns and does something for herself. That's a big thing, and that's the point of the movie. Because before any, when she starts, she's one of those girls who like won't even with like is so meek, is so sadly ineffective at life because she's just, I don't know what's keeping her back specifically, but I've known a lot of people like that who are just like they're just afraid to speak up even when people are directly addressing them. And you know, through this, you know, short-lived group of friends that's torn apart by an unfair, shitty world, she slowly, you know, finds her feet and finds, you know, maybe she doesn't find real direction in her life, but she at least discovers that she can have some strength by herself.
You know, I think maybe it's because the development is, like you say, it's minor. It's, she starts out as very meek and eventually kind of, by the end of the film, is grows some agency, I guess, and a little bit of confidence. And she learns some life lessons from Parker Posey's character. But I guess in service of realism, it's not like she then changes the world or quits the job or any of that shit.
Well, she does quit the job.
Does she quit the job at the end? I couldn't.
It says literally first line of dialogue since, you know, it literally the story ends when she left it.
Oh, right. Okay. No, you're right. Sorry. I watched a lot of this stuff in a row here. But
And like it ends with her, you know, announcing her leaving.
Oh, right. And then she gets the recommendation and everything. But, yeah. So, yeah, it felt a little slight. It felt a little like, okay, all right, well, that's your character arc. Uh-huh. I guess I just didn't connect with it too much. I really thought, you know, Frances Ha was like, wow, this is so life-affirming, and, like, they don't make movies like this. Like, you know, like, movies that actually tell people in their late 20s, like, you can do it. It's going to suck, but you can do it. You're not as incompetent as everyone says you are. Like, that's a nice message. Movies like this, I feel like plenty of them exist. But maybe I'm being untouchable.
I can't think of another movie like this. Maybe, not even
well,
close.
Not exactly like it, but in terms of the themes of office, like I said, office ennui, and not being a little directionless, I feel like.
And like usually, I said, this is not about office ennui.
Usually, it's much more broad. The themes in this film are usually much more broad, and they're told in like comedies.
Right.
So you have a point there, but. Well, okay, so if it's not about office ennui, then is it just being directionless puts you in this place, and then that place changes you, and you break out of it?
Well, that's kind of a... I think it's more about, you know, through your interactions... Yes, through your interactions with people, you can slowly discover yourself and, you know, eventually learn to stick up for yourself and what... I don't think she would have done that had her friend not been, you know, unfairly judged by everyone, even herself.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. Like I said, I didn't dislike it. I just, I felt it was.
Look, it's a real subtle character study, and it's definitely, you know, this movie is divisive. I've shown it to people, and they, a lot of people get hung up on little details about it that are not the point. Actually, I remember I showed this. I loaned this movie once to JOD,
John O'Donnell, for the
John O'Donnell, the famously cartoonish head of Central Park Media, and he came back to me, and he was like, "I was enraged by this movie." She referencing Parker Posey early on when she picks up the phone. You know, it's a credit agency. The guy wants to talk to a higher up, and then she sees the higher up's preoccupied and then just says, he says, go ahead and sell. Have a good day. And that made him just fly into a rage. Like, that cost how many, who knows how much money that she just destroyed someone's life.
That's that's a great thing to focus on.
Right.
Yeah, no, I could see how it would mean different things to different people. So that's a sign of, to me, that's always a sign of like a quality piece of work is when people can read different things into it. When it's not super thudding and, like, obvious. But interestingly, the thing I sort of latched onto was because... So I'm a big fan of, and I'm very happy it's back on, the HBO show The Comeback. And Lisa Kudrow, who I think is a really underappreciated actress...
Oh, she's fantastic.
...is really good in this and does a few things that her character in The Comeback... I don't know if you watched that show...
Actually, a very good friend of mine is in it this season, so I've had to watch it. I actually have trouble with that show because Lisa Kudrow's character is so well-realized and so appalling that it makes me uncomfortable.
It is like pure strain, like the purest form of cringe comedy, but it's so brutal and dark that it's like barely a comedy.
Oh,
like,
God.
It's so brutal. I love that show. Anyway.
I can tell.
Watching her in this movie, she has a few little tics and everything that are similar. But, yeah, it was nice to see her in something like this, especially because this would have been... Was this like a summer movie, like an indie she did in between
seasons? Yeah, this was a Sundance movie.
Well, but I mean like in between seasons of Friends, because Friends had started by 96, right?
Oh, yes. This was definitely a summer break movie for her.
Yeah, so it was interesting to see that. And, you know, the rest of the actors are really good. It has a really good cast and everything. And I enjoyed the details of the world that they had sort of built. Distracted it once again by the whole, boy, it sure was like that in the 90s, huh? When, like, temp workers would have been really... not just desperate for every single hour they can put into the place. Your comments are interesting, and I may well revisit it one day. But it felt so slight to me, and maybe too subtle. Maybe that was it. It was just a little too slight and subtle for me.
I'm taken in by Sit in the Ether movies.
I know. I'm extremely familiar with this.
And this is like the way the narration works and everything. This movie felt like that for me. I was able to really kind of sit in and inhabit this world.
Yeah, well, I know that's your thing, because you give me at least one or two of those every year, you know. And at this point, like, I can, you know, rattle them off. It's like Mormon Keller, Fish Tank, like all these movies that are exactly like that. I like seeing
usually
them.
Female driven.
Yeah, totally. Like I said, I didn't dislike the act of any the act of, well, okay, the Ozu movie was tough to watch, but I didn't dislike any of them. And I found something to take away from all of them. Like I said, I highly recommend Francis Ha. I cannot imagine if you're an Ozu fan, you haven't seen Late Spring. And I think the premise alone, if you're kind of like me and are sort of drawn to movies about that are about office culture, or at least that's the premise. I know that's not what the movie is about, but that's the premise. There's something in here for you, so it's worth checking out. It's pretty goddamn obscure. Like,
yeah, there DVDs are out there, but there's three different pressings, and only one of them is letterboxed, and the rest is pan and scan. Really? That's how obscure this movie is.
All right, so let's get to what I gave you.
Yes, let's.
Very different films.
Holy shit, where do I begin with this one? Okay, let's start with the first one I watched, which was Noah.
Darren Aronofsky's.
Yes, from last year.
This year, that came out in spring.
Oh, they did? Oh, okay. Didn't do great domestically, but it did well overseas. I didn't hate it.
Well, good.
Boy, does this movie have problems.
You think so? All right.
I don't understand what they were doing, what they were going for, and a whole lot of the decisions they made in this movie.
Okay.
The CG, they clearly bit off more than they can chew, and it doesn't really mesh well, especially in the compositing. But there is some truth to it. There are some great moments, and the performances are fantastic. And parts are believable. Okay, I'm just going to come out right out and say this. What the fuck is up with the anthropomorphic rock monsters?
Okay, so this is Old Testament. Old Testament. That's all in the Bible.
Anthropomorphic rock monsters are in the Bible.
Mud monsters. Yeah, those are the bodies of fallen angels. Those are angels who were cast out of heaven and went to earth against God's wishes to help humanity. And he cast them down and cursed them to stay there, and they get stuck in the mud. And so they're there, and they're there to help humanity, but they're these sort of tragic mud beasts that are, you know, at this point very old and sequestered because humanity has changed a lot in the time that they've been on Earth. That is what those are. They are sort of weirdly, the movie's post-apocalyptic. It is taking place in a world where there is a creator, and he used to communicate with the people. And there's a living memory of a time when our creator communicated directly with us, which you can imagine if it happened now, even once provably, would change the entire world forever. The little balls of the little like light things that are in the ground, those are leftover remnants of the creation of the Garden of Eden. It's a world post God, but everyone who is alive knows that God is there and is controlling their fate.
Right.
Which I thought was a really fascinating premise for like a fantasy movie. Like, if you secularize this, it's a really cool idea for a fantasy movie. But that's what the big rock creatures are. They are fallen angels.
Right. Okay. I'll accept that then.
Didn't know what to make of it, huh?
No, I really don't, because it's exceedingly slow.
See, I was pretty captivated, but it's my kind of slow.
Okay, yeah, I don't like this kind of slow, because I was giving nothing really to psychoanalyze. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not entirely true. What they did with Noah's character was actually fairly interesting to me. I thought it was actually very interesting how to take the idea of, you know, a biblical figure, very prominent biblical figure, and really kind of take a step back and go, well, what does that, when you have that much responsibility riding on you and you have to sacrifice that much, what does that do to your soul? Like, what does that really, like, that has to screw with your head.
Yeah, and the movie, I think, does a really excellent job. He descends essentially into madness. For half of that movie, he's glowering and stalking around the Ark, thinking about murdering his family. So
yeah, I don't know. The whole, like, I'm going to murder these babies thing was a little much.
Well, but that's the point. That's the point. The point is that, you know, the movie starts and he's the only, he's the last, you know, aside from Methuselah, who's touched by God and is allowed, you know, basically has this abnormally long life because God blessed him. Noah is living by God's rules. He's the last person who is still living by God's rules, which is take only what I give you, and that's it. The rest of humanity, led by Ray Winstone, God has abandoned them. And they're like, why aren't you talking to us? Fuck you. Fine. Then if you're going to leave us down here, then this whole planet's ours and we're going to do whatever the hell we want with it. And they become a bunch of, well, horrible monsters. And so Noah is the last sort of person who's still living by God's rules. And he's realizing this is an incredibly conflicted decision for him to make. And he basically says, like, if I'm going to do everything God is telling me to do. And it's never clear that God is actually telling him any of this, by the way.
Right.
It's clear that there is a divine, but whether or not he's actually speaking to Noah is up for interpretation. And the fact that he's misinterpreting this, he is, and at one point, like, the whole point of the, like, second act of the film is that he's misinterpreting what he thinks God is telling him, and he thinks it's his job to eradicate humanity and completely wipe it off the face of the planet because they're not worthy.
Right.
And so he's just saving the animals because they're innocent. They're the only creatures that deserve to live. And it's an argument between him and Ray Winstone, who's basically saying, God put us here. He created us. He left us here. And now he's abandoned us here. So why don't we just take it all for ourselves? Which is a perfectly reasonable attitude to take. So it's an argument between those two guys. And I thought that was a really, really interesting way to...
Let's face it. Ray Winstone's character is not... in any way, shape, or form hinted at being right about this.
But his attitude is understandable. And there's moments where he's angry at God. And there's moments where he goes and he's yelling at the sky and he's saying, like, what the hell? And he, like, takes one of those rocks off the ground that's evidence that there was a creator, that there was a divine, and shoots it into the sky and is like, where the hell are you? Why aren't you talking to me anymore?
Right.
And that is, like, an argument. Like, to me, that's a really powerful, like... statement of somebody who is losing their faith and doesn't have it anymore and therefore is no longer guided by it, and it changes his character, turns him into somebody who's just acting out of self-preservation. And it's a totally understandable position to take. He's living in desperation, but they've been abandoned, so what do they do, you know? And I feel like it's presented just in a way that allows you to at least empathize with his position and see where he's coming from.
Right. No, that's an interesting take on it. I didn't care.
Well, it's a big movie about big things. And I think it takes this biblical story that a lot of people, you know, the classic image of Noah's Ark is smiling animals walking into the Ark two by two.
Well, don't get me wrong. I'm not exactly attached to that imagery.
No. But I'm saying, like, I think this is, like...
If I wanted that, I'd play the crappy Wisdom Tree NES game.
Yeah, or Super 3D Noah's Ark, yeah. But, like, this I thought was a really cool, really well done. It felt really handmade. I loved the way the special effects looked. I thought they were purposefully looked really primitive and ancient.
Everyone looked like they were floating on grass to me.
It didn't look like flashy CG. It was intentionally meant to look like crude stop motion.
There is good work here. I don't want to take that away from it. The CG, like, you can tell they really labored on this CG. It's just, it was kind of uncanny valley for me.
Okay. See, I didn't feel that way. I thought it looked like it had been hewn from rock. and therefore fit the ancientness of the story that they're trying to tell.
Oh, okay.
That's what it came across to me, for me anyway. But the other stuff I really liked was that this is Old Testament through and through, and that is unsentimental and fairly brutal. The sequences where the ark, where the flood finally takes humanity, and they're just sitting in that ark listening to people die around them for, like, days.
Yeah.
Like, it makes you think about that stuff, and it's like, God, that's horrible.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that is a terrifying story.
Yeah, right, exactly, but the way it's traditionally told is all smiles and sunshine, so... seeing it this way, I think, really opened up my eyes. And I really liked the idea of Bible stories being retold in a much in a way that appeals to a secular sensibility, but is still taking all these concepts and ideas from, you know, these ancient stories and making them relevant and exciting and giving you a chance to think about what they were trying to say in the first place and what they say now, what they mean now about faith and humanity and all these big subjects. I thought Aronofsky directed the fuck out of it. I really loved the sequences that, like, the creation of the universe and original sin, which is violence in this film.
Right.
I liked the tracing back of Cain killing Abel to as being original sin, basically. I just thought it was all really, really well done and fascinating. I loved the shit out of it. It was one of my favorite movies of the year.
Wow. Okay. Well, I didn't hate it. It was like I thought there were interesting parts to it. It's probably worth seeing. You know, not, you might not. It, okay. This is my Clock Watchers, I guess.
You got something out of it, but it just didn't quite touch exactly. You.
not my kind of movie. The next film, though, interestingly enough, also an Old Testament adaptation. Also was marketed with the exact same disclaimer as Noah to ward off the biblical literalists.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Like word for word, exact same disclaimer.
Yeah, I think that's just standard.
Yeah. I hated this movie.
I'm excited to hear what you hated so much about. So the film is The Prince of Egypt.
Yes, which is famously the first DreamWorks animation.
Yes, and I gave these to you as kind of an Old Testament double feature. Of movies from Old Testament stories that I happen to really love, even though I'm not a religious person. And I thought they sort of fit together in a box that I sort of label like religious movies about religious stories that I happen to really love. So what did you hate so much about The Prince of Egypt? It's just the story of Exodus.
Right. And there's, you know, the story, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Although I think it's funny that they... I can't imagine doing that any other way, but I do think it's funny that they end the story right after, you know, the successful crossing of the Red Sea. So they end on an up note rather than dwell on the fact that for the next 40 years they will wander the deserts aimlessly.
Yeah. Yeah, right. There's no sequel.
All right, so a couple things. I respected its animation for its era. Mm-hmm. And you can tell it was a very, very ambitious project. I don't think it holds up all that well, especially the character Ramses. You know, the way these films are broken up with the American system is every character gets its own team of animators.
Yeah.
The Ramses team clearly had a lot of trouble staying on model.
His head changes shape a lot.
Oh, my God. He is not recognizable in certain scenes.
I think they had trouble with that character design. They were trying to go for realistic, like what a realistic Egyptian man would have looked like.
Yeah, they succeeded somewhere between Yul Brynner and, you know, generic black, bald black dude.
Yeah, yeah.
It was all over the place. But, okay, that was a problem. The biggest problem with this film for me was the script. The songs in particular, the musical numbers are, the songs are, you know, middling. What they do with the songs is just death, which is nothing. Every time a song starts, the story grinds to a screeching halt, and the song plays, and it does nothing, and it adds nothing, and it's interminable, and it goes on for minutes and minutes, and you just want to just gouge your eyes out because it won't stop.
See, I didn't have a problem with any of the songs except for the low point of that film, which is the Steve Martin, Martin Short number. It's fucking horrible.
Well, you know, they were like, they couldn't even decide if they were aiming for comedy, so they just kind of half-assed it, and it doesn't work. Like, it barely even reads as comedy.
Well, the thing that irritated me about that scene was that it was, what it was saying was that, oh, the religion that these people practice is just smoke and mirrors, snake oil bullshit. And I was like, hey, you can make your movie about competing religions without suggesting that one of them was completely false. Like, I know this is, you know, I know this is a story, but that whole, they turn that into like a funny song.
Hey, well, I don't think anyone's actually actively practicing that religion today.
No, but it's just, it seemed really like, no, of course nobody's actively practicing that religion today. It just seemed.
Wait, which in the age of Tumblr, I'm surprised isn't the thing.
It seemed callous to me. If you're going to present it as like, oh, well, you know, these people don't worship the real God. It's like other versions of Exodus kind of stay away from doing that entirely, like just straight up delegitimizing the practiced religion at the time. I don't know. It felt a little crass to me, but, you know, other than that, I really liked the movie.
I thought Noah was, or not Noah. I thought,
Moses.
Yes, Moses was dull as dirt.
Okay. I thought he was fine.
I didn't like, he didn't seem like a real character to me. He was just kind of, it was just all very rote and going through the motions. And, you know, I guess, you know, you could argue that it's kind of like, you know, seeing an opera that way, where it's just like all these just huge emotions and, you know, big, huge things happening. And I guess there's something to be said for that, but in a film or a medium such as animation, which is something we marinate in on a daily basis, mm-hmm. you can do so much more. You have the ability to have all these subtle nuance expressed in facial changes, in body language, and you can really give a character life without a whole lot of dialogue. This movie didn't even try. Moses was just an everyman. You know, he acted exactly how every other, like, spunky as a kid, and then, oh, basically his character is interchangeable with Simba. You could put Simba in that role and have the exact same movie, except he's a lion.
But that's, no, I don't think that's true, because the character arc of Simba, he is running away specifically from his responsibilities, and then, you know, what's-her-face shows up and is like, hey, your home is a fucking wasteland now. And he's like, oh, shit, and goes back. This is, well, like, he's...
In this, he runs away from his princely responsibilities once he finds out, you know, his secret.
What?
And
no,
goes
no, no.
into hiding for a while, and then, you know, oh, his people are in trouble. Yeah, that's a pretty much the exact same arc.
That is not accurate. He is raised as royalty and then slowly sees the suffering of his people illustrated in front of him, and he realizes he can't ignore it. And he doesn't
see anything until his long-lost sister shows up.
Well, okay. He goes down to the slave quarters and starts seeing things, and his mind is... He realizes he has to do something about it. Then he has a vision. And the fact, okay, so a big part of the reason that I kind of, well, not a big part, a part of the reason I like this movie so much is that they had the audacity to make Val Kilmer, who is the voice of Moses, also the voice of God. And the thought of Val Kilmer.
Yeah, that was kind of funny, actually, because they really do sound identical. Like, it's not even a different voice Val Kilmer is doing.
It's just puffy Val Kilmer. Like, doing the voice. I don't know. See, like, I thought the animation's really nice. I like the way that movie looks a lot. I think the first act is the strongest.
Right. No, the first act looks pretty good. It wasn't until they were adults that I was just like, wait a second.
Well, no, I thought all the stuff where, you know, they're brothers together when they're younger, I thought that was compelling. I enjoyed the narrative there, and I liked the characters. I thought they were reasonably fleshed out for being fucking Moses and Ramesses. I mean, you know, what... What else do you do with those characters? They're larger than life. But I thought I humanized them pretty well. Like, I didn't have the same feeling about Moses than you did, and as you did. And to me, this was like, is Jeffrey Katzenberg basically waving his dick at Disney, which is what he was doing in the late 90s. And this is, we're going to make a Disney Renaissance movie, a la in the style of Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid. Well, we're going to do fucking Exodus. And it's going to be huge. And it actually wasn't that huge. It did okay. You know, they didn't break until Shrek. But as a film, as a well animated, I think pretty, and I thought the songs were okay. As one of those telling this huge biblical story, I think it works. I thought it worked really well. Like, I find that movie to be very entertaining, fun to watch. I you know, the emotions in it, I think, resonate. I think, you know, you're complaining about the character animation, but I think it's pretty good a lot of the time. Yeah, I just, as an adaptation of Exodus, I prefer this one to pretty much all the other ones. I have not seen the Ridley Scott one yet, which I hear is just all spectacle and no character, but what a shock for a Ridley Scott film, I know. Right. But
that never happens.
Yeah. But I don't know. I really like that movie. And I sort of put it together with Noah. I think Noah's a lot more daring and has, like, way more edge to it. And
it has some ideas, certainly.
And it has a lot. It's asking a lot more of its audience than Prince of Egypt is, obviously. But as together, it's like, hey, you know, those are the movies that I tell people, like, hey, yeah, okay, it's based on a biblical story, but it's not like a Bible movie. Like, it's not sitting you down and telling you to be Christian. It's just telling a story from this old book of stories that have, you know, changed the world and how impactful they are. So,
nonetheless, this movie is apparently required viewing in every Midwest church every Passover.
Really?
Yep.
No, it's the easiest to digest one. It's not like 4 hours long, so I could see why they'd go with that instead of that shitty Charlton Heston one. I mean, I would pick that one too.
This movie is kind of poster child of why Justin avoids the vast majority of Western animated features.
Yeah, well, you watch them. I mean, you get to them. Usually, I guess, on assignment from me.
I mean, I'm skipping Big Hero 6.
And you're right to do that. You're right to do that. The movie was not good. Yeah, okay, well, sorry you didn't like it. I thought you would at least think it was sort of a novel that they tried to make a Disney Renaissance style film out of that story. And
Disney Renaissance was already going. That was concurrent with the Disney Renaissance. It wasn't special.
No, it was after it had ended. That was late 90s. Prince of Egypt was late 90s. Disney Renaissance ended.
Right. Yeah, that was after that was like Emperor's New Groove era.
There, yeah, it was in the same year as something Mulan or something like that. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. It fits in the same box as Noah, like I said to me. So, sorry you didn't like it, though.
Well, you know what? Let's get to a movie I did like.
Oh, good. Thank God. All right.
There was one.
There's usually this one.
This is actually a current film that's in selected theaters now, but it's also for rental on iTunes.
Yeah.
And I highly recommend everyone check it out, especially if you like horror movies, which I don't really, but I still loved it. And it is called The Babadook.
Yeah. I loved this thing.
It's a little low-budget Australian film about a widowed mother of a six-year-old boy who is kind of a problem. This kid, I mean, in a normal sort of way, like this woman, she's working at an elder care facility, and, you know, her life is already stressful and rough, and she misses her late husband, and it's just, she's living not a great life. One night she's reading a story to her son, and her son pulls out mysteriously this book she's never seen before called The Babadook. And she opens it up, and it's like this really kind of dark, macabre, like ornate pop-up book about a monster that comes to attack you in the night. And the kid's freaked out. She's a little freaked out. And she's just like, okay, like the kid's inconsolable. But from that point on, the kid sees Babadook, and she doesn't. And there's just this slow buildup where, you know, you slowly realize, and she slowly realizes that the Babadook not only is real, but is a real present threat that is inhabiting them regularly and doing great harm to everything around them. and their lives are in danger, but they don't really have any resources or friends that they can count on to save them. Really incredible filmmaking, especially when you consider that this is an incredibly low budget film that was shot very quickly with a 6-year-old.
Right.
who's actually very good in it.
Yeah.
They were asking a lot of the 6-year-old. The woman playing the mother, her name is S.E. Davis, and she is phenomenal. Like, the tonal switches she was completely pulling off, completely believably, were just jaw-dropping. It takes a lot to scare me in a film, and this didn't really scare me, per se, but it kept me intrigued. I was really, I was wrapped pretty much the entire time, and it's very real, very believable, and it's also kind of a rare treat to get a film like this from an entirely adult female perspective. That doesn't happen very often.
You definitely don't see movies about mothers, like movies about mother characters.
Good mothers.
Movies about mother characters that are made by dudes fall into the, oh, mom was perfect, or mom was a total monster, horrible person. You can tell it was written by somebody with firsthand experience with these emotions.
Yeah, no, it's an incredible film. The director and writer Jennifer Kent, was this her first film?
I don't know. Probably, I can't imagine it. If it was, then
it's definitely her breakout film.
Yeah. If it was, then geez.
Yeah. It's very well made. There's not a whole lot of CG, but what there is pretty great. It's genuinely creepy, and it's also very set up for a sequel or a spinoff.
See, I didn't think so on that one.
Well, not involving those characters, but, you know, you could do anything with the Babadook.
I guess, to me, it's such a straightforward metaphor. Like, it is a... like, the best kind of horror movies are metaphors. Like, they're allegories. Mm-hmm. And this is as straightforward as they come. The Babadook is a manifestation of frustration, misplaced rage, homicidal levels of anger towards people you truly love that are making your life miserable.
Right, resentment, in other words.
Resentment, yeah. Resentment that turns into misplaced rage.
Yeah.
And it is such a great metaphor for that. I was genuinely scared during the film in some of these scenes, because I thought the metaphor was working so well that I was, you know, those emotions are fucking scary things. And if you've been around somebody who is dealing with them not well, it's a scary thing. It's extremely frightening. And so it was working on both levels for me, and it terrified me.
Because I was talking around this, but I texted you halfway through it.
Right. Oh, yeah, you did, yeah.
Because, I did have some experience with this growing up, and it's being a little crass to say it was making me nostalgic, but it was definitely giving me flashbacks.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to the quality of the film, where you are expressing those tough emotions so well and saying something that is simple but profound about them. And the conclusion of the film is fucking perfect. I loved the ending. I thought it was realistic and honest about those feelings as much as it possibly could be. And I won't spoil the ending, but in terms of like what you want out of a good horror movie, I don't think you can do better than this one right now. Like, what I want from a good horror movie is something that gives you something to think about and is scary and creepy and is dealing with aspects of the human condition that are truly really terrifying when you think about them. And this, I think, manifested those like perfectly.
It's a fantastic film. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Yeah, there's a big misstep at the very end, and close to the very end. They use a generic monster sound effect that totally kind of took me out of it, because I hate it. It's like hearing the Wilhelm scream.
I did not even notice it.
Yeah, you know, lucky you.
Mind you, I was watching it at home. I had quiet because it was pretty late.
There's one sound effect in there. It's like, oh, why did you use that? But other than that, yeah, no. And I didn't think it looked, I mean, you can tell it's low budget, but it does, the cinematography is really nice. So, like, I didn't think it looked low budge, like, at all, really, at least in the cinematography. It was really
well shot. There were a few times where I could tell, like, it was like, oh, they were really scraping for footage to fill pad that out.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, but for the most part, it was it was pretty seamless. I don't know, sound effects issues like that don't really bother me like that. There was this one door squeak that is used in everything from I've heard it in anime, I've heard it like in at least 100 movies, and now when I hear it, I'm just like, oh, that, damn it.
Yeah.
I forget about it pretty quickly.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm glad you liked it. I was thinking, I was like, there's no way he's not going to get something out of this.
No, yes. Justin, enjoy.
Cool.
The one thing you gave me this year that I actually enjoy.
That is usually how it goes.
Now, last year, we did pretty well. I looked it up. We did pretty well last year.
Okay, well, it's different every year, at least. All right. So we have some Twitter questions to get to, but before we do that, we'll get through these quick. I asked you if you had like a top five for the year as so far.
Yes.
Because a bunch of movies open between now and the end of the year. Like, it's Oscar season, so all the good movies are opening now.
Yeah, I have so many to get to, and so many like through the year that I wanted to see that I just didn't have a chance to because I was so damn busy.
Right. So if you do have the top five, though, I would like to hear them. And you can just list them off. You don't have to go.
Okay. I have four and one that I was really, really scraping for.
Okay.
So so my top five is actually, honestly, number one is Whiplash.
Okay, right. That's on mine, too.
I love this movie. This is it's in a limited release now. I hope it'll go wide and get some Oscar buzz. Didn't get any Golden Globes, I don't think.
It has plenty. It has Oscar buzz, at least for J.K. Simmons.
Okay. Yeah, he won a DGA award, I think. But it is a really intense story of a really motivated, driven, kind of dickish music school student who's attending a prestigious music university, and versus his band teacher, who is just one of the most angry, violent, vicious teachers that should not be teaching ever. But somehow the pressure makes him better.
The movie's about destructive masculinity. That's
what, yeah, kind of.
I think it's very clearly about that. But yeah, I really like that movie too.
Yeah, so that's my number one. Number two is Boyhood, which I know you're not that big a fan of.
Yeah, sadly. I feel bad about it.
Well, you should. Kidding. I love this movie. It is a Float in the Ether Justin movie.
Yep. That's what I thought when I was sitting there watching. I'm like, this is Justin the movie.
It is. It's kind of wistful. It's full of little nuggets of wisdom and little frustrations that everyone will identify with. It doesn't really have much of a story, but it's not about story. It's just, it is watching someone grow up in time lapse, and it's incredible, and there will never be another movie like it. We'll be studying this in film schools for generations.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to win Best Picture.
It deserves to. I mean, 12 years in production. Number three, I know it's not, wasn't made, finished in 2014, but it was released here in 2014. And that is actually The Wind Rises.
Oh, yeah, sure.
We've talked about this on the show. I love this movie sexually.
Yeah, I reviewed it, so if you don't know what I think of it, you can go read the review.
Yeah. Number four is actually a Chilean movie, a historical period piece called Simply No.
Yeah, you gave me that on Blu-ray. I saw that. It's really good.
I love this movie. Interesting, they actually shot the whole thing on vintage 80s tube cameras.
Yeah, you can tell. It's cool.
Yeah, which gives it a very unique look today.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, it's about the media campaign surrounding the no vote for the referendum on the rule of Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically how the story of how they more or less have to resort to a Mad Men style ad campaign and just make it a commercial for happiness rather than, you know, look at what awful shit this dictator does because that just turns people off. Just fascinating on so many levels. I really, really great film. Number five, which honestly isn't that great, but I just didn't see a whole bunch of stuff, was Chef.
Oh, yeah. I really liked that movie. It was a lot of fun.
The only reason I wasn't more keen on it was because it was such a rote crowd pleaser.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't really take any real narrative chances or anything. And it didn't really make you think all that much. But it's a very respectable, very nice, family-oriented film about, you know, a chef that kind of self-destructs under the pressure of Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And criticism, modern food criticism, and kind of embarks on a journey to find what he loves about food. I love food.
Yep.
I love food a lot. And this movie is really expresses what I love about food. And there's some really touching moments with his son. Cliche as they are, they are genuine. And it's a fun film. I recommend it to just about everyone. It will never be one of my favorites, but I do like it.
Yeah, I like immediately recommended that to my parents.
Yeah, totally. Can I just go through the list of movies that I still need to see from this year?
Yeah, if you want.
Okay, I really need to see It Felt Like Love.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
This will make you laugh, but I really kind of wanted to see Bad Johnson.
Okay.
Tale of a guy whose cock goes on strike. Runs away. Let's see, Rich Hill, which is a documentary about very, you know, impoverished kids and their coming of age. The one I love, the Mark Duplass comedy.
Oh, yeah, I haven't seen that yet.
Need to see Fury.
Really? Standard-ass World War II movie.
And deleting that one. Need to see Nightcrawler.
Yeah, that's next on my list, actually.
Need to see Theory of Everything.
No, you don't.
Really?
Oh, God.
I'm hearing complete polar opposites on that.
Fucking shit, I hated that movie.
Really?
Oh, man, it is... It may as well just... The title of it may as well just be Oscar Bait Biopic.
Okay.
Holy fuck. I was enraged that movie was just automatically considered a contender for Best Picture. And that
it's that manipulative, huh?
It's that rote. It's that fucking point A to point B. Like, oh, man, that movie made me mad. I was like, this is only getting awards because it's British. And it's okay, about then. And it's about like you could have probably made a much more interesting movie about Stephen Hawking. But anyway,
that one. Foxcatcher, need to see.
Yep. That's on my list.
Need to see Inherent Vice, which just came out today.
Yeah, I'm probably going to go up and see that.
Yeah, need to see Mockingjay. Still haven't seen Mockingjay.
Yeah, it's a really great half a movie.
Yeah, and need to see Cake.
Yeah, that's a dark horse kind of best actress.
It is, but honestly, Jennifer Aniston is so underrated as an actress. I would watch anything with her in it that's actually like not a shitty rom-com or something.
Rom-com, yeah.
Did you see The Good Girl?
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. That's a good example of like, hey, if you put her in something that's serious and actually demands things of her, she's a good actress.
One of my all-time favorite movies. I love that movie.
Yeah, it's cool. It's good.
So yeah, what's yours?
I'm just going to run through them. Number one, Birdman, favorite movie of the year, easily. Loved it.
I respect that one. It didn't click for me.
It's an art movie that doesn't take itself seriously, which is basically like, you know, how Boyhood is kind of you, the film. Birdman really spoke to me.
It spoke to a lot of people.
I know. I'm not claiming some kind of special status. I'm just
No. I'm just like, you might be more quote unquote right on this one.
Well, absolutely rapturous praise for Boyhood, I think, but now this is, I don't think I'm going to spend a whole lot of time running these down, but yeah, no, a director I'm not particularly have ever been, like, in love with, I think finally stopped taking himself quite so seriously and actually made a film that is playful and yet profound and also extremely well made. It's trickery, but it's meant to look like one long take, and that gives it this forward momentum that is thrilling. Like, I was thrilled by this movie because of the way it was made, and I was really into the characters and really loved what it was saying and how playful it was and how many different kinds of things it was trying to say. And yeah, cool movie.
Does have amazing performances.
Yeah, totally. And I miss Edward Norton. I wish he were in more things.
Yeah, he's pretty great in this.
Number two, Noah. Number three was Whiplash. Number four, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which was fantastic. I love those movies. They're the most thoughtful blockbusters around, and people, I think, they don't get a fair shake from the film intelligentsia. They're really smart, really good social commentary, really, really well made, really, really well made films that I wish that me listing that didn't automatically like elicit kind of a really. It's like, yeah, it's really fucking good, man. Those are really good movies. Then The Babadook was the last one, but that could have been swapped out for Gone Girl or Chef or Interstellar, actually, which I liked way more than I thought I would, but I acknowledge it's a very flawed movie.
Did not care for Interstellar.
I know you didn't. And I don't, that's one of those movies where you would say that and I'd be like, I know, I know. But for whatever reason, I found myself pretty captivated by it and really liked what it was trying to do. I liked, it was Chris Nolan and I Am a Space Alien, teach me what human emotions are. Like,
I was just happy to sit in a giant film IMAX presentation of Pretty Things for 2-3 hours. So.
Yeah. No, I don't know. Like I said, it's not in my top five, and I don't think it would be in there, but I liked it. Yeah, my list is pretty similar to yours, although I'm chiefly looking forward to Inherent Vice, even though I hear it's pretty... I don't know what's up with PTA, but I guess it is long past the point of being considered a Best Picture contender, and...
Oh, no, really?
Well, it's a druggy comedy type thing. It's the lead character is like a Hunter Thompson type, set in the 70s in Southern California. Like, it's based on a Thomas Pynchon novel, for Christ's sake. So, there's no Best Picture buzz for it. But I'm really excited to see it because I love Paul Thomas Anderson movies.
I'll see it anyway. And
yeah. I'm stoked. I'm probably going to go up to the Arclight for it.
I just have this kind of feeling that I've already seen the best film of the year.
Yeah, probably. I feel kind of that way too, but there's so much else coming out. Like, I want to see the other contenders. I want to see The Imitation Game, even though I'm pretty sure it's not very good.
I'm not even going to bother with that one.
I watch everything that's even nominated. So, and I feel like that gives me a good sampling of what came out that year that's worth seeing. So I'll probably see that Angelina Jolie movie, the inspirational story of the Olympic guy in World War II, that stuff. And I really want to see Foxcatcher and yeah, but I feel like my list probably won't change much depending on how I respond to Inherent Vice, which I think is the one that has a chance of being on my top five, but, I haven't seen it yet. So who knows? I have a bottom five.
What's your bottom five?
Bottom five is A Million Ways to Die in the West, worst movie I saw all year, and I watch a lot of bad movies, so that's saying something.
I've not heard anything good about that.
It's a black hole where comedy goes to die. It is the anti-funny. It will remove humor from your life. Like, things that you thought were funny before won't be funny anymore after you're done watching that movie. Oh my god, it's terrible. And Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, fucking horrible. Amazing Spider-Man 2. What?
Saw that train wreck coming.
Yeah. Amazing Spider-Man 2, probably the worst major blockbuster I've seen in a really long time. Worst, like, okay, you will note, I saw Transformers. It's not on this list.
Wow.
Wish I Was Here, the Zach Braff movie that I was kind of waiting to hate, and I was rewarded with lots of hatred. I can't believe
you went and saw that.
I didn't go see it. I rented it.
Still.
I had to know.
Cinematic cutting, Zach.
Yeah, I know. I'm a masochist. You know it. You know this about me.
I do.
And then number five is actually that Muppet movie that came out. It's fucking terrible. Like, the one that came out a couple years ago was totally in the spirit of Jim Henson, and I was really hopeful that they would have kept that spirit alive, and nope, throw away shitty, boring sequel that feels like it was made by people who don't understand why the Muppets are popular or successful at all. So big letdown on that one, but I used to really love the Muppets.
I saw the one from a couple years ago, and I honestly, I'm just like, I don't think the Muppets are for me.
Well, if they weren't for you when you were a child, then...
I like Muppet Babies, but that wasn't really the same thing.
See, like, one of my all-time favorites, it's like the double feature that I just watched over and over again when I was a kid was Pee-wee's Big Adventure and The Great Muppet Caper. Informed my sense of humor a lot, and Jim Henson had a fantastic sense of humor, and that was largely missing from everything made after his death. And the last movie, the one in 2011... recaptured that really, really well, and so I was excited because they were finally making something that felt like it was from that era, and then nope, not anymore. So that was a one-off. We got one more good one, and then that's going to be it. Anyway, so let's get to these Twitter questions.
Yes. Oh my god, we're at 2:38 on our clock now.
I know. All right. Okay. Kit Flowerstorm asks, were there any trends vis-a-vis conventions this past year that we could, going in forward into next, that we could look forward to? Not that I noticed. Like, convention stuff, I think conventions are in a bubble right now. Like, comic book conventions and anime conventions are in the middle of a bubble, maybe on the other side of the peak.
There's so fucking many, and, like, I think the more people I talk to, the more I'm starting to realize, especially with the bigger ones like New York and San Diego, a lot of people are not having a great time anymore.
People are finally figuring it out that those shows are a fucking nightmare to attend and not fun. People are figuring it out. Yeah. Like, once you go once and you see, oh, look, it's a guy in a fucking Batman costume, and look, all the movie studios are here, you know, cramming commercials into my eye sockets. Once you see that once and you realize they're all like that, they're all exactly like that, and it's wall-to-wall people, and it's kind of miserable, like, mm-hmm. I can't imagine it would stick around for long, but... that's not what drives these conventions. What drives these conventions is culture and hype. And I think next year is going to be a huge year. Next year and the year after it are going to be really huge for this nerd culture that is now mainstream. I think 2017, you're going to start seeing some of these shows go away. Some of these conventions disappear. I think the audience for them, the throngs, maybe will subside after we get through the next big slate of Marvel films and the new Star Wars comes out. I think then you're going to start seeing some exhaustion with nerd culture and maybe get to a point where it's not the big shit anymore. It's not the big
I feel like these movies have just taken over movies, and it's a nightmare, and I want to wake up.
Well,
no one does anything interesting anymore.
Okay, but you still had a list full of movies you really liked and a bunch you really want to see. So it's not like...
true, and all of them were... completely indie or foreign.
Yeah, but they still make them. They still make them. See, I used to be like, oh, look at all these mainstream stupid nerd movies. I mean, I watch them more than you do, but I always try to come back to the realization, look, movie making is huge. It will pretty much always be huge in my lifetime, and they always make plenty of movies every year that are not like that. You just have to seek them out. You just have to look for them. Anyway... Divine Nega asks, any thoughts on where the U.S. side of the industry might be headed next for 2015? We got another question about this because you tweeted saying, oh man, next year's going to be interesting.
Yeah, and I didn't actually specify the U.S. side, but that's what I meant. The U.S. side is going to be interesting.
Yeah, and I think interesting, not in a bad way.
No. I think it'll be great for fans. I think there's going to be some shakeup.
Yeah, but not like scary like 2007.
No, not like the world is ending. Everyone's going to lose their jobs. Holy crap. Everyone's, you know, standing in a breadline shakeup.
Yeah.
I mean, like, didn't see that coming.
Yeah, people may be making some bold moves. But, you know, we're speaking in generics and we have to. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Let's just keep your ear to the ground. Try not to be pessimistic.
And read Anime News Network.
Yes. We'll cover all of it. Okay, Redneck Otaku asks, what was the best animated film of the year, any country or medium, and why? Well, I guess, for you, obviously Wind Rises.
If we're going by things that were actually released this year, Princess Kaguya.
Yeah, well, that was released last year in Japan, right?
Damn it. I got nothing.
That was last fall? Yeah. I mean, for me, I haven't seen Kaguya yet. It's playing at a really crappy little theater here near me that I might trek over there and take a look. Because I kind of don't want... I guess I decided I don't really want to wait for the Blu-ray, but it's not playing in most theaters anymore, so...
They haven't even announced a street date for the Blu-ray, so...
Yeah, so maybe I'll go over there. It's still playing there today, so that means it'll be there through the next week anyway, and maybe I'll check it out. I guess for me it would be... It was a bad year for animation, so...
It really was.
You know, Wind Rises aside... excuse me. I guess it would be The Wind Rises. I didn't... How to Train Your Dragon 2 wasn't good. I didn't like Big Hero 6. So...
Hated Letter to Momo.
Yeah, we just put a review of that up today.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Theron liked it more than you did.
I watched it with Michael Cernan-Nicholas, who directed it.
Yeah.
Directed the dub. And at one point, late in the game, or late in the movie, I literally just turned to him and gestured... Holy shit, really? And he just kind of, you know, shrugged like he does, politely. That was, yeah.
Okay, we have two that dovetail into each other. Fuzzy Proxy asks, are there any major anime titles you missed and plan on checking out? And the next question is, did either of you watch Monthly Girls Nozaki-kun? I didn't. And that is a major one that I intend on checking out. I assume you didn't see hardly anything new aside from Terror in Resonance.
I see a few things here and there. I saw Free.
Of course, yeah.
no comment. And like I just kind of wait a year or two to see what everyone's still talking about, and then that's what I seek out. It doesn't seem like there's anything that like really moved the needle this year.
The Nozaki-kun, I think, might be the only thing that everyone was talking about, how much they loved it, and I need to watch it. It's short, and I can get through it pretty quick, so...
Okay.
But, you know, we just, right now, we're in the middle of doing this gigantic mega poll, ranking every new TV series from this year. And right now, as we're sitting here, it has something like 16,000 votes, something like that on it.
Sure.
I guess by the time this podcast comes out, the results will have been made public. But in terms of stuff that I missed, I'm currently watching at least two of the things in the top five and watched one of the other ones. So I don't feel like I missed out on a bunch of really big things this year. Tomorrow, actually, we're taping this on Friday. Tomorrow, we're seeing that Expelled from Paradise. Film, so I don't know if that's going to be a big deal or not, but I feel like I'm keeping up with anime much more than I used to now in terms of watching stuff as it airs, just because I'm keeping up with hype a little bit more. I don't know. It makes me feel like I'm a little bit more in tune with what people are excited about. So let's see here. Brogan27 asked, do you think we'll get a rebuild of Evangelion 4 next year to put a cap on Evangelion's 20th anniversary? No, we won't.
Definitely not next year.
Because Anno said, no, we're not doing that for a while. So probably a couple of years before we see that film. I'm excited about the 20th anniversary to see what sort of merchandise they're going to let me buy. And I want those Blu-rays, obviously. I will murder a person for End of Evangelion on Blu-ray.
Yes, holy crap. I pre-ordering that. I don't care if there's no English on it. I'll add it. Do it myself.
Yeah, I don't need English for End of Evangelion. I practically have that movie memorized.
Pretty much.
Branko Berkson asked, what did you learn from doing the new streaming reviews this year? I learned that people like it, and it's popular and successful, and I'm really happy about that, and it really helps that we learned to curate on that and tailor it towards what audience will actually read instead of spending time and resources on episode reviews that like two people read. And that those polls are a really good way to show us what you want us to cover. So there's going to be a lot more of them, and please vote in them because it helps us determine what to cover. So yeah, I'm happy we launched that this year, and it'll be full steam ahead on that stuff for 2015. And I also wanted to point out as we conclude here, a lot of new content coming next year from you. You have a new column launching.
I do.
In January. So in just a few weeks from when you're hearing this, you'll have a new column. We're excited about that one. That's going to be cool, I think. We have another, like, three or four new other columns in the works. Some really exciting stuff. So from the editorial side of Anime News Network, please look forward to 2015, because there's going to be some cool, fun stuff happening, I think. And we're taking some risks and trying some new stuff. So, yeah. So thanks a lot for sitting here for almost 3 hours and doing that.
Yeah, well, I'm glad we only do this once a year, but it was fun.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, hey, Happy New Year, Merry Christmas, all that stuff.
You too.
And
to everyone listening.
Yeah. No shit. Okay, that's our show. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating, a review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'll see you all in about 2 weeks.